Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Pruitt? Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Mead?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Okay, first up is audience communication. Items on the agenda, not on the agenda. Nobody signed up. Once, twice. Okay, moving on. Study session, and we're back to brainstorming. Okay. City manager.
So I just wanted to say to the council that I thought last week was great. And I also know it's impactful because I've had at least one department head who is working on their objectives and budget priorities put a hold on that based on the brainstorming from last week. And that's exactly what should happen, because the direction should start with the policymakers and we infiltrate through the organization. So I'm already seeing results from just the one meeting you had. So I think that's awesome. Tonight you guys wanted to focus on just two of the focus areas or goals, fiscal responsibility and customer service. Obviously, I'm my subject matter expert here in the fiscal responsibility to help you guys if you want to brainstorm that. And then customer service is something really that pertains to every department and every function of the city. So maybe we'll start with fiscal responsibility. I think everybody, Gina, already has sticky notes. Is that right? And markers. And we got thinner markers upon request, so they're easier to write with. So hopefully that'll help this week. So again, for Council Members Steckler and Mead, who weren't with the team when the original guiding principles were established, I know there was a lot of discussion at the time around fiscal responsibility. I know that's been a hallmark of the city's management really since its incorporation. And so the goal you eventually settled on was to responsibly manage the city's financial resources to provide quality public services, cultivate economic prosperity, and maintain a sustainable budget. At the time we were developing this particular budget, we were working through the budget deficit and balancing the budget. So there was, of course, a lot of conversation around that. And we were also talking about just short-term and long-term financial planning. I don't know if any of the other council members council members Mead and Steckler's benefit have any additional background they want to give on this particular goal. Or if you guys want to kind of get right into brainstorming.
Ready to fill out little stickies? Everybody's
right.
Working on their stickies?
Does it balance?
Better balance, right?
I
Ready, Warren Peaks.
No pressure.
You say it takes longer to do hieroglyphics, doesn't it?
We should have some music.
I know, we should do that. That's awesome.
Oh, no, I didn't get it done in time.
Wow, you guys are verbose on this one, huh?
Verbose.
And that, you know, kudos, because that takes a talented council to get engaged on fiscal responsibility. I mean, well, not for everybody. I'm impressed.
You're going to shout.
That can be judged. That's right. Good on you.
Did Jared up there, you got the memo about the big black shirt?
Black shirt.
Tiny, though. You should tell me one.
You can call it black.
Yeah.
It's got a little red to it.
Oh, okay.
You did, yes.
Peggy's in shock.
No, you could just tell it's the finance director. She's analyzing them.
Did you put some off the chart to the left? No,
that was me. I just stuck them there for parking.
Oh. Carefully analyzing. I love it.
Over to the left. Maybe not in a good way. Out of the box.
There you go.
Out of the box thinking.
I'll die. Separate on your concepts, so I'll stick it down here.
Surprise.
That's what the chief did last time.
Okay, you might.
You want to start with one group and walk us through, Peggy?
I will lead us through.
Thank you.
So, the topic is fiscal responsibility to responsibly manage the city's financial resources to provide quality public services, cultivate economic prosperity, and maintain a sustainable budget. So, the first group, identify wasteful spending. And I think that goes hand in hand, that we need to identify that so we can save for a rainy day. Proper planning to avoid defects. Deficit.
Okay, can hold on 1 second. So I had a question. So identify wasteful spending. Do you think that's different from lean, or do you think that's part of the philosophy
Absolutely.
Of lean, or is that separate in your minds?
Absolutely part of it.
Okay.
We've started doing that really since day one. We've seen a lot of processes that were duplicated. We've seen, not to Monday morning quarterback, but we've seen one person reporting to one department director, just a kind of overkill on staffing and whatnot. So I think when you identify those and start to trim it down and find out what you're actually cutting the checks for, you get more bang for your buck. When you realize that you're spending too much money in your household, you find out what you need, what you don't need, and you just kind of trickle it down from there. What's appropriate, what isn't, what's wasteful and what isn't.
And I think, you know, lean is really, it's a philosophy, it's a belief system, it's not something with an end date on it. And so for me, you know, this is a result, right, cutting wasteful spending. But we also want to, you know, as much as we want to cut waste with lean, we also want to build capacity with lean. And so the more you cut the waste, the more capacity you create for employees to do more fulfilling things we haven't gotten to. And so I think that's the flip side of identifying, you know, wasteful spending or waste, if you want to use the lean term, is creating that capacity to do more other more substantial work too.
Well, and also that there's a tendency in some government organizations, because we've always done it that way.
Right.
And you have to constantly keep reevaluating and analyzing, much as what you did the first year, and continuously since then. So you can't be afraid of change.
And I think that goes to culture, too. You have to create a culture where employees feel empowered to ask those questions or bring ideas, and even sometimes fail, you know, because not every idea you're going to hit out of the ballpark the first time. So I think there's a cultural aspect of the goal, too. Peggy, I'm sorry, can you proper planning for, what was the rest of that?
To avoid deficits.
Okay.
And I think that goes along with, we've also got midterm, long-term planning, no surprises, clearly defining short-term versus long-term revenues, sustainable long-term budget. Those all,
yeah,
in my mind, speak to the same concept. Any comments on that, or we're good? Seek out economic growth opportunities. Anybody want to comment on that?
So, to the council, what does that mean to you with the city nearly at build-out? What is economic development opportunities mean to you?
This wasn't mine, but I wrote something similar. It might be the one you stuck next to.
Yeah, make it easier for businesses, yeah, to locate to the city.
So I think that might kind of build into that, where, like you said, close to build out. We have opportunity. We have empty spaces. We have places for businesses to come, and they haven't. And so I think kind of tying it into what we talked about last week of, it's in my experience talking to some of the local business owners, it was difficult to start and figure out, especially compared to other cities around us, difficult to start. And so making it easier for small businesses that are looking for a place to find us. And
so difficult to start as in not being familiar with, you know, it's not something you do every day, an entrepreneur
it's
who doesn't
along those lines where this, yeah, exactly. Where, and I would think, I would love to be the person that goes and talks to more about this to small business owners, unless that's a staff thing, but kind of that idea of getting more information from some of these small business owners, the newer ones in particular, and saying, what were some of the struggles that you went through getting to this place now that you're here, established in Mill Creek, particularly the gelato shop where one of my friends worked that we talked about last week, speaking more to that owner about the process, what they went through.
So we actually had a meeting today on that, and we've asked Tom Rogers to actually meet with that owner. Because I think there's kind of three things that could come up in that category we want to nail down. One could just be people who are entrepreneurs and don't every day start a business, and so it's like, where do I start? And so that's a potential to collaborate, like with Economic Alliance, who's putting together kind of some how-to materials that we could partner with on that. I think then there's another that, well, if there was a particular process that was difficult, then, you know, that we have control of, that's something we could work on from a process improvement standpoint. But then I think there's another, you know, was sometimes people or businesses say it was difficult because of the standards they had to comply with. And so that's a policy decision, right? Someone may find, and I'm not saying it's the case in the individual you spoke with, but someone may find it's difficult because we don't allow certain signage, or we have certain setbacks, or we have certain landscaping design plans. And so, yeah, I think we have to be careful to kind of say what was difficult and how do we address those things. And if people find, you know, the sign ordinance too restrictive, we could certainly bring that for a work session with the council. But those to me are like three categories.
Totally.
That, yeah, could be
someone doing the work of basically surveying, you know, those,
right,
people. And it's something I'm interested in, and I would love to do it. I just, as this process, the city council is different than,
right,
a legislator who can just go talk to her. And so kind of working with you to figure out what the process would be to do that research, essentially.
And so,
I'm not saying I know the answer,
right,
what the struggles were, because I don't specifically. I just know there were struggles, so I'd like to know specifically so we can talk about it as a council, whether it's signage or whether it's the difference between not having a chamber and, you know, whatever it is, I'd like to just know so we can try to make it better.
Well, and I think there's an opportunity there, going back to the discussion last week, for collaboration. So I think we could work with, like, EASC and the Mill Creek Business Association, Town Center Business Association, and do a survey on this topic, and have our communications department work with those agencies on a survey and kind of bring those results back for a conversation and a work session with the council, but really getting some data from our existing businesses and then some generic polls just for people who thought about starting a business and, you know, what's keeping them back from that. So that's a really good strategic objective from a budgeting standpoint.
Can I add a little something to that? Because going back, Jared was talking about, I always like this, last week and this week, starting a business. I'm really focusing on starting a business. And it would be interesting in the survey if we could really be focused in on going to the business people in Mill Creek and asking them, what could the city have done differently for you mm-hmm. in your first year of business that would have helped you mm-hmm. dramatically? Mm-hmm. And see if there's something that I'm sure, I mean, it might, you know, be 100 things we can't do, but there might be a gem in there that's something mm-hmm. that we could do that would then be something we could use to promote businesses coming into Mill Creek in the future. Start here because this is what we do for you in your first year of business to help you. And we know this is something that would really help them. It's hard to start business.
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah.
First year, hardest year of all. We're the city that really tries to help you through that first year. That could be a way to gain that economic prosperity. When you can't develop anymore, economic prosperity is coming from more businesses wanting to start here mm-hmm. because of what we do.
And then one other that I didn't mention was that dovetails in with the economic growth is don't just rely on increases from revenues, but we have to do some economic development to help support the city services.
Yeah, I think a good example of that is what you're doing with passports.
Attractive to people like Arena Sports, or when I go to the grand openings, nobody has said the city was difficult to do business with. Everybody's been very positive about, you know, the city making staff available, noticing things. So
they certainly have the opportunity to complain, but, you know, they don't. And
I'd like to see us continue to work on economic development as a source of revenue. So
What kind of economic development is the council interested in?
I'm interested in what delivers sales tax revenue or delivers revenue to the city. We have a limited amount of space. We have to maximize the utility.
And we have to make it worthwhile of the people who own the land, because we don't own it, to maximize their revenue also.
And with that, you know, you have a... To me, this category, at least as to the extent you're talking about economic development, you know, makes me think of like the Dobson-Remillard property. So, you know, it are exploring economic opportunities with that property encompassed in your mind as part of economic development, whether that be public-private partnerships, whether it be developing it from a sports tourism standpoint, but exploring feasibilities and options for that.
I personally wouldn't want to see Dobson-Remillard be anything but a park or a field or a recreational or tourism opportunity. I mean, you don't sell your parkland. You can't make it anymore. But that's just me.
But, yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking from a council perspective, is looking at options and feasibilities for that property, something you want to put under an economic development umbrella.
Isn't that what your tourism zone is?
Well, we've talked about that, I think, conceptually. You know, I think what I'm just asking is, I guess concurrence, is that, you know, is that what we want to look at as part of our economic development, continue building the tourism, the recreation zone, exploring feasibility options. I'm not asking you to commit to something, but do we want to explore those options? I guess I'm just trying to get a feel for that.
I want to jump in on this, but Mark wants to say something. He's been waiting patiently to say something.
Thank you very much. So I wrote the first one that was read. And when I was on this particular thing, I'm open to discussing the property, but I share the mayor's passion for not losing what little is available. So I would horse trade it and say, if this isn't a good use for what we want, a park, but this church could relocate here, it would be a great use for them. And we, you know, so I would, I'm open to creative thinking. I'm also, what I was thinking in my head when I saw that is land use. So is this zoned for the best interest for the neighborhoods it's around, as well as the economic viability of the city? And being, you know, things are changing. What's cryptocurrency going to do, should it take off, to our city and how we do business? And is there going to be opportunities for us to be involved in that and help our businesses thrive in this crazy new whatever it's going to be thing coming down the pipe? And that we also look and say, you know what? We looked at this annexation. It didn't make any sense, the 128th corridor there, whatever. But now it's 10 years later, and it does make sense. So just keeping an open mind and not just getting caught into the trench where you just, you dig and you're digging. I'm going that way. And, you know, but kind of just, are there clever, creative, out-of-the-box things that somebody else is doing or that we haven't thought to do that would make sense and allow the city to thrive and the folks that are working in the city to thrive?
Yeah, I love your comment about, you know, keeping an open mind and thinking about the future. I've just read a lot of articles in the last couple of weeks about what other governments are doing. It goes back to my original presentation about making deliberate, you know, making time to deliberately plan the future. You know, and these cities are planning 10 to 20 years in the future and, you know, really looking at things from signals that, I think it's, I want to say Atlanta, but I may have the city wrong. But they're actually deploying apps now that integrate with signals on in emergency systems, so people know, you know, when there are traffic issues and these kinds of things in real time. A lot of just really interesting kind of, you know, 20-year out thinking. I read an amazing article just even on parking, because we're always talking about needing more parking spaces, and they were talking about, you know, following the trend of driverless cars and how that may impact what's traditionally been thought of in terms of parking planning. So I liked your comment, because I think it's so important when we're doing things like economic development planning and thinking about the future, not to think about today, but really what do we think the world will look like in 20 years?
I know we talked about, well, since we're on the subject of economic development, I know we continue to have to look for revenue streams for the future, and I know you and I have spoke kind of
heavily on it a few times about creating a taxing district, whether it's sports and entertainment, in that area of, I'm not trying to put a shot across,
but the arena sports venue, the fields over there, Mill Creek Sports Cards.
That area, by creating that area for tourism, sports, entertainment, and whatnot, I think that would be an appropriate discussion to have at some point in the near future.
Incentives, tax incentives, economic development incentives?
I know many cities carve out, well, maybe not carving, so not the right word, but they use areas, whether it's for lodging taxes or sports and entertainment taxes, to collect fees to continue running the city's operations in those areas where we're growing.
I mean, while we're growing, we still have to maintain it. So,
yeah, I very much think we should have an objective to come up with options for what to do. I think there's an opportunity to come up, as the mayor said, with some community asset that also promotes the tourism, whether that's the Donna Michelson Memorial Water Slides or the Steckler Performing Arts Center or the ball, expanding the ball fields, or doing some creative joint venture. I think there's some unique opportunities we might be able to find that meet a lot of goals. So I think we should spend some time looking at that and seeing if there are some options, and so we can make some decisions.
We don't want to limit ourselves.
Yeah.
Government constraints and more of a business, but we're trying to create fiscal responsibility. It's like what we're talking about, but it's some of it that talks about isolating the profit centers and the cost centers first in any organization, and then going in and ranking them as to which ones are the most profitable to even to the ones that are the most costly, and to be able to create a budget or a futuristic look at our community that would be fiscally responsible. I think you're all saying this. What are other cities doing to generate income out of development? If your development's gone, what are they doing? What could we do? And I think, you know, we might find that these are some of the, you know, greatest new cost centers that are becoming available, revenue producing entities for cities that maybe we should look at, something we've never thought about before. You know, somebody mentioned hotels once, and I know it's kind of weird to think about Mill Creek with a hotel, but even a, you know, a conference center or a, you know, place for retreats. Or I'm hearing about a little bit of research I've been doing of things that a lot of cities are creating just for the purpose of maximizing revenues when they don't have the development anymore, mm-hmm. or the constraints of it. So it's also isolating the cost centers. And so we talked about that, of, you know, from sewers to other risks that we face that we need to be aware of and rank and have a top of mind awareness, because to have a, you know, fiscally responsible budget, you also have to get, you know, this is likely to occur. It hasn't occurred for the last 5 years, it hasn't occurred for the last 10 years, which means it's even more likely to occur. Now we should start thinking about that, preparing for that.
And that is really hitting on why this year's focus is on that capital improvement plan, because that's a huge missing piece of our financial picture. So I think that's very intuitive.
Next category, why we are all here and live here. Keep Mill Creek affordable for long-term residents. Earn public trust through transparency. Educate the public and respect for the citizen taxpayer. All of those, to me, go together. Any comments?
I put educate the public, and I guess the comment I had before I get to that is, we haven't really talked in these discussions about the goal overview, which is why is the goal important? And that's, this one is particularly important because to me everything we do depends on having the trust of the citizens. And getting on a little bit of a soapbox, some politicians at a national level have worked for decades to create this perception that government needs to be small, and to achieve that, they've convinced a lot of people that everything government does is bad and inefficient. And certainly there are many examples we can point to, particularly at the federal level, less so at the state level, but I think even less so at our level, that what we do is just inefficient. And we operate from a presumption of inefficiency. And if we don't have that trust of the citizens, then when we go to them for a tax increase to support EMS or a proposal to do something creative with Dobson Remillard, we're met with suspicion and reluctance. And so, and I put, that leads into the comment about educate the public, is because I think they need to understand what it is we're doing. The best example I come up with, and I don't mean to call any local papers on the paper, are on the table, but how many times have we heard recently, Mill Creek has the highest sales tax in the state? How much of that are we responsible for? Isn't it 0.1%? Mm-hmm. Other than the one decision that was made, what, 8-10 years ago to pass that, we have the same sales tax everyone else does. But to the public, we have the highest sales tax in the state.
And we, I think, have no utility tax.
But
that's
where I was going. I mean, what the public, I don't think, realizes is we don't have a utility tax like virtually every other jurisdiction. We don't have any debts. We are very fiscally responsible. And then we see it with the property taxes. I mean, people see their property taxes go up. Mine went up almost $1,000 this year. But I bet if you looked at the bill and compared it to last year, your city portion of that is $40, $20. It's going to vary. But the bulk of it is the increases are decisions the voters made, whether it's passing RT3 or passing some county initiative, or it's stuff that's outside of the control. So to me, this is critical to what we do. We've got to educate the public on how the finances work and the realities so that they have trust when we make these decisions and bring to them or make decisions on various things. So I'm off my soapbox now.
I think one of my sticky notes was earn the trust of the public as well. I think it might be up in that same section, but I can.
Yes, it is. Earn public trust through transparency.
Be
being transparent is part of educating the public and making sure that people know what's going on so that when we have to go back and ask for things or talk about projects that we want to do, people trust that we're making decisions that make sense and are efficient and not working from a place of assumptive inefficiency. I completely agree, and I don't want to beat a dead horse. But,
yeah. And I did about keeping Mill Creek affordable for long-time residents. A previous council member, Benton Bacon, was on our council about 20 years ago, a heck of an individual. And he came out of Chicago, and he talked about how nobody intended for taxes to get out of control. But you look at some of the eastern states, Connecticut, it's just people didn't stop spending and it just kept going higher and higher. And through long-term planning and stuff, hopefully we can avoid that. And you look around us, even in Snohomish County, and everybody's got a utility tax but us, and nobody's any better off than us because they just didn't plan ahead. They just kept piling stuff on and spending the money. So I really like the idea that we're taking a long-term approach and we have a chance to avoid mistakes and actually engage the public in what it is you want to do and what it is you want to pay for.
Well, I think, you know, this concept of the transparent and educate the public is important. And I think one of the challenges is, you know, is the business that comes before the council comes in segments, right? And oftentimes it's in percentages, you know, 1% increase here, 3% increase there. But when you start bringing that whole picture together, we all know, right, from having done this now together for a while, that a 1% tax increase generates approximately, give or take, about $60,000 for the city. You take that $60,000, you know, the fire contract, you know, that's $600,000 increase in a biennium. You take the guild contract, that's $100,000 in a year, $200,000 in a biennium. You know, that's $60,000, and that's just two contracts. You know, that's not SERS, that's not Snohomish 911, that's not these other things. And so it is a challenge to figure out how to stay ahead of those increases that you have some but not a lot of control over because of the way that the system is set up in the state. And it is challenging to explain.
All right, let's see, long-term viability of core services from a cost perspective. I think that the comment charges for services reflect our costs for individual benefits and costs for services for common good are reasonable and efficient, reasonably efficient. Recognition, inclusion of full costs of programs for our that would include our internal cost, I believe, was what you were indicating, Mike.
Yeah, I think so often, you know, in the private sector, if you're going to do something, you have to have the ability to sell it to somebody at a price that covers all your costs. And it's an easy fallacy to get into in government. We don't count everybody's time towards a project. But truthfully, I'm going to pick on somebody. Gina's time right now is part of the cost of the 35th Street reconstruction project, and a little bit of Rebecca and a little bit of Peggy. You know, it's if you did full cost modeling like you do in the private sector, you'd say some of these things are expensive. Now, some of those things are small amounts. Gina's cost on top of a $6 million project is not a big deal. But if we're in a basketball program, we seldom think about there is a full-time person working real hard on that besides paying the referees and buying whistles and stuff like that. So it's easy to get in a mode where you don't think about what those costs are. And we're not always going to have, lighten up to John's comments earlier, we won't always have we won't have a profitability in every cost center, but it's interesting to look at those things and say, if this is something that is of a benefit to an individual, like when they come in and get a permit, we really ought to charge them everything it costs, so long as we're doing it efficiently, to do that. If it's something for the common good, it's the extravaganza egg hunt, well, it's hard to put a cost on it. We're never going to get money back on that, but we've got to feel like that was a good value for the taxpayers' dollars. So everybody goes, yeah, smell test, that smells pretty good. So that's what I was kind of trying to get at there.
It's almost that line on the financial statements, the charges for services that lend itself to that. You've got passports, you've got your building and development and plan check fees that we want to make sure that we're recouping our cost which set the price.
On those where we can track, and then Mark goes way back, and we can get into another time maybe, but you know, the whole, we came to a philosophy a number of years ago. Our Parks and Rec program was supposed to be 100% reimbursement, well, minus 15%. So we came up with this 85% number on all of our Parks and Rec programs to say that's about what we think they ought to pay for. And that influenced what we decided to charge for some of those programs. It influenced some of the programs we decided to offer or not. I think that was an attempt to get to what are reasonable services that we're going to provide or not, and what are we going to charge for them, even though we didn't put that in the charge for services category. It's its own
cost center. We set that up as an enterprise fund so we could look at it like a profit and loss, like you typically would look at in a business, but said we had this threshold of 15%, and I think if you recall from the financial report, we looked at it and we're cost recovery of 80% without the general fund. So the general fund is still supplements that. And I know we went through a cost pruning effort, if you will, for the cupcake class that just didn't generate, didn't have the people there, and it cost us more to put on than it was worth.
Didn't you also have us stop charging non-residents more because it was costing us more?
Yeah, so through the lean process, we were actually going through the endeavor of having a cost differential if you were a Mill Creek resident versus a non-resident. This was before me, and they went through the exercise and decided, you know, it just cost us more to segregate those two groups and add the incremental revenue. So we did away with that, and now it's a, you know, one charge.
And I think, too, we have changed, right, over the past few years, that focus where it's not just solely recreation program. We do community event programming, too. And so we don't obviously charge for those, but that goes to, like, the goal of the civic pride and the community engagement. So that becomes a dynamic. I do agree, because your tax structure only generates $60,000 a year, you'll never keep up by just trying to tax your way ahead of the curve. So I think this is a really important key component of our financial plan, is really the actual fee structures, and do they recoup the cost of providing the services for which we apply a fee to. And there may be some decisions you make where you take the information and say, okay, no, we don't want to recover all that for various policy reasons, but you should at least know what you're supporting.
So mine was just respect for the taxpayer. And I think fundamentally it's good for us to just remind ourselves regularly, this is somebody else's money. They did something. They gave up family time. They made an investment in themselves and their education or whatever, and they went out and they earned money, and they voted in policies and people and whatnot and said, we'll trust you with this money. We want you to make roads and provide good services and police and fire, and we trust you. But if we just remind ourselves, this was somebody's blood, sweat, and tears, that they it's value. It's not just found. That helps remind me and helps me prioritize where I'm going. But with the Parks and Recreation, it's challenging there. So the example that I've used, I came in, was when they had an outline. It was a belly dancing class. It's $500 to give the class, and 10 people showed up, and they collected $25 a person, so they collected $250. It costs. That's not reasonable. I can't go to taxpayers and say, hey, are you cool with subsidizing 50% of a class for 10 people to have belly dancing? That made no sense. We had karate classes where the city was providing little, you know, mini black belt thing, but competing with the 10 different little dojos out here that are trying to do the same thing. And we were using government money to subsidize and undercut the business people. And then we're like, why are they failing to thrive? Well, they can't compete with us. So those are pretty clear examples of where that's not why we're collecting people's money. But the Easter egg extravaganza, I think that's like an extra that the citizens would all agree, you know what, we don't have you as government collecting taxes to do that. If that was all you were doing, we wouldn't do it. But it's a nice little thing, and we're cool with it. If it changes and they say, no, that's not a priority, and we don't want you doing that, I'm on board with it. But the feedback I've gotten is that's well-received. They know we're not making money. They don't expect us to collect money to comp. They like that we partner with other people to reduce the cost. And same with like Christmas tree lighting and other things. So there's a balance between those, and we just need to diligently assess them, and sometimes they need to be reassessed.
No, I think that is key, is you do have to constantly kind of reassess things, and, you know, policymakers change, policies change, communities change, financial situations change, and you have to prioritize those things. And that's why I do think continuous improvement is so important as part of our core philosophies, because it goes to continuously evaluating things.
Two examples of Parks and Rec where the citizens might be comfortable with a minor loss because of the perceived benefit would be a short day class on dog obedience and, hey, welcome to Mill Creek's Parks and Trails. And by the way, here's where you find bags to scoop up. This is the leash laws. This is when you should muzzle. And, yeah, we may not recover the cost to give that, but maybe there's a bigger benefit by providing that service. And babysitting classes. City used to give babysitting classes where students of the age to get started in babysitting would come down, and maybe a police officer or a school teacher or firefighter would say, this is basic CPR. This is where you can sign up for some CPR classes for a higher level. And boom, 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 boom. This is, you know, sort of a general safety thing for a 13 to 15-year-old who's looking at getting into babysitting. And we, you know, that we could say, you know what, that's probably okay to lose a couple bucks because there's a bigger picture that we benefit in.
Well, and I think that recreation programs typically lose money.
Sure they do.
In cities, because it is, you know, you can't recoup it, or you would be, you know, as comparable as the private sector. But I think it goes to what is your philosophy, you know, for the city. I know when we did the goal setting, we talked a lot about active recreation. You know, that's why you have ball fields, that's why you have trails, that's why you have those things. So we've called a lot of what we do recreation programming, and I think some of it is, like the basketball program. But part of it,
right.
I'm sorry?
If we run our parks and recreation right, we can actually offset the babysitting class where we lose a little with a 3-on-3 basketball tournament where we made some money.
Right.
And we can use the other side to carry the others. The profitables to the, well, your thing,
costs.
Well, and I think, too, fundamentally, governments and the business it's in, because you can't make a profit out of it, generally speaking. There's exceptions, right? I understand that. But I do think it goes to, you know, cities typically provide recreation programs because the communities feel like they're a benefit to the quality of life in the community. Now the question then becomes, what recreation programs? Is it cupcake decorating and babysitting, or is it, you know, 3-on-3 basketball, or is it a mixture of both? So
the one that I've been,
well made.
The one, and the last one, I want to make sure I didn't forget this, are senior programs. These people have been paying their whole life. They've carried the log for a long time, and it's okay, in my book, to say thank you and do things that enhance their quality of life as they and get to that point where maybe driving to Everett isn't an option. And they want to have local things. And that's, I think, something I would support, even if it doesn't make money. I do support it, not that I think. I do.
You know, that raises an interesting question, because I have been approached by a few seniors who are on fixed incomes, worried about the increasing cost of particularly taxes. And so has the council ever looked at any kind of senior exemptions? Is that something that you're interested in?
We have looked at it in the past, but we haven't done much with it.
How about look at? But it's... they're just really limited.
Okay. But I think with our aging population, Parks and Rec with relation to our seniors is just going to be a bigger, bigger demand. It's going to cost more and more, and we're going to have to discuss what does that mean to us and what level of service are we willing to invest there.
Right, I heard... fee schedule. So one of the comments up here is to review, modify, update fee schedules as needed. And that goes kind of dovetails with what we touched on lightly, rank and isolate profit center and cost center. This will help us to evaluate the risks and opportunities. Any further discussion on that? All right. The other topic, well, let's hit this one. It's kind of by itself. Preservation of infrastructure, which would include roads, sidewalks, parks, utilities, et cetera, for the long term.
So that was me. So I was thinking, if we look at fiscal responsibility, that means taking the revenues we get and dealing with them appropriate. And so I think that's one of the things we're, and Rebecca will chime in here, that we're going to look at the long-term capital plan, but it's irresponsible for us to start stuff that we can't continue is a big one for me. And one of the things that city has a lot of is infrastructure. And we were blessed with brand new roads when we incorporated, blessed with brand new sewer pipes or storm sewer pipes, but those things wear out. And so I think it's, to me, real fundamental is we need to be making sure we're taking care of that stuff. We've all driven through cities where you go, this is a mess. And we all know that once you get beyond that end of life, reconstructing things is a bigger deal than preserving them. So you think about our state's capital. You walk around down Olympia, it's just horrible. Jared spends time down there. But you get off the campus and you go, this is a sad place. And it's Olympia's got issues with not having enough money to fix their infrastructure, which is crumbling. And it's embarrassing. And once you get to that point, it's hard to redo that. So we talked about civic pride. We talked about community preservation in prior week. We will lose that pride. We will lose that preservation if we don't look at this from a fiscally responsible standpoint. That is the biggest asset we've got to maintain. That's our main responsibility. But that in certain core essential services, that was my other thing, is, you know, we've made a promise to people we're going to have police. We've made a promise to people that we're going to keep it clean. Those are the core things we got to do. And these other things are all would be nice. The extravaganza, profitable or not. The basketball program, profitable or not. Those are all would be nice things. That goes back to the priorities of government stuff that was big, what, 10, 15 years ago. We've got to look at the core things we've got to do and make sure we can do them long term before we come up with other sexy, fun ideas. To me, that's the basics.
Well, and I think, you know, getting into the capital improvement program is important, because I think this really is kind of a new stage for the city, because you did have that lead time for so many years as a newly incorporated city. But it is, you know, a real key point of fiscal responsibility, right? You have to maintain your infrastructure, and the more you delay it, the more expensive it will become. And I agree with Councilmember Todd, is that, you know, if you ignore it, and I used to live in Atlanta, and they ignored their water sewer infrastructure problems for decades, and it went into the billions of dollars and really became a crisis. And so I concur that that can happen, and we don't want that to happen. And I think that's where you get this whole picture developing, and that's why the economic development portion of fiscal responsibility is important, so you can then, you know, be funding and preparing for your capital improvement program that you are preparing for years out. And, you know, we want to achieve all the goals, right? We want people to feel part of a community. We want to have a safe community. We want a clean community. We want a maintained community. But all those jigsaw puzzle pieces have to interlock. And we have to be working on long-term planning for all of those. So I do think, and right now, I think our critical piece for long-term planning is nailing down a CIP. And that's going to go to the fee structure. And we're going to come back, and we're going to identify, here are our needs on stormwater. And while I don't know what the fee recommendation will ultimately be, I do know it's not going to be enough where it is now to deal with the problems for the next 20 years. And so that's where we have to start really getting the planning coordinated.
Well, I think that maintaining our infrastructure is part of economic development. Because people like to be here, our sidewalks are nice, our roads are nice. Mike is right. You wait on this stuff, you let it go, and it costs you so much more. And it's really hard to get back with everybody yelping, what about me? So I'm excited that we're going to have a long-term plan that will protect our infrastructure, because that's going to be absolutely one of the top priorities.
And that planning also can help you fund it, right? If you have it in your CIP, grants become available, funding becomes available, you can be prepared to take advantage of that.
All right, we have up next established threshold for financial deficit and surplus. Financial plan must match strategic plan, but should not direct it. I think also that kind of encapsulates those two concepts are negative trends need to be changed, positive trends need to be utilized, and we need to review the five-year trends to help forecast needs.
That was me. There's a few things there, and again, it's healthy fiscal planning is always a product of what we've been talking about, research. Going back, if you have a three-year plan, go back 5 years and look at trends. See if there's things that we're forever predicting in a three-year plan that we can be proactive as opposed to reactive on. If you're going to write a five-year plan, go back 10 years. And if you're going to look at other cities that have our same age, I mean, when we incorporated, we had these great streets. Well, what is the longevity of those? What other cities in a similar situation would they face? And I think that being as proactive as possible shows the greatest amount of responsibility.
And whatever we can do that research, I think is something really, really, really critical. And then when I looked at trends, and I love trends, negative trends, they're out there. They're good to recognize, so you can say, okay, we need to change those. This is getting more expensive. Positive trends, if you can find any. And I was thinking of one as I was listening to Mark over here, and I'm talking about, we have existing parks, right? Taking an existing park and some cities have turned them into off-leash parks. And as citizens who take their dogs down there, give them that wonderful freedom, make a donation into a donation box or something. That all of a sudden you're generating income from something that was just a straight cost center before. And looking for trends like that maybe we could be thinking about. So I was like in any good budget planning, before we write the budget, let's do some research to help. What's the right word? Give a structure to it. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't my opinion. This is facts. Mm-hmm. This is trends. This is what I've seen. That's what all that off realistic notes was going at.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on those?
I would just say for some of these things, which I agree with trend analysis is just a basic component of financial management. But to get to that point here, we're going to have to do some investment in the infrastructure because the financial systems don't lend themselves to be able to get that information easily. And that's not a criticism. That's just a product of the age of the city. And its growth and maturity. But to be able to do those things, we have to have the tools to do those kinds of things. Otherwise, it's so labor intensive, it's counterproductive at that point, or it's not very reliable. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the quarterly report. But I just wanted to mention that because I think it's such a good point that as we put this together, some of these goals will require other foundational work to get to it. And so that's a good example of foundational work that has to happen to kind of get to what we want to do with that trend analysis.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've heard people talking about fear of what's coming, what's going to start breaking down. And everyone, I hear that so much from both up here and over there on the other side of the city, that it's clearly a reality.
Mm-hmm.
We should have a plan for it. We should have. We should be able to tell the citizens, okay, you're right. Here's what we think is what needs to happen, and when we think it's going to happen, how we're going to handle it.
Then our final theme is wrapped around policies, one-time revenue streams or one-time events, reserve policy, and implement policies that keep spending at or below the projected revenues.
One of those might have been mine. I did mention setting thresholds for reserves. surplus as well as deficits that prompt action. In other words, when we get too much of a surplus, we need to, that's going to prompt an action.
Right.
If we have too much of a deficit, that's going to prompt a different kind of action. Guts. But just that we need to set thresholds of both surplus and deficit for good fiscally responsible budget.
What do you mean by a surplus threshold?
Say we've got $6 million in surplus. Is that too much? Is that not enough? If we set a threshold, our threshold is X based on, you know, good information. Say that the surplus should be no more than $3 million. $6 million surplus, that's going to prompt an action. There are some repairs we wanted to make, some things we are concerned about. That would prompt an action to spend that money on those predetermined elements that you don't really know when to predict.
It's easy to say what to do when you got a deficit. Mm-hmm. If you got a deficit, you don't have enough money, so you got to cut some things. But a surplus is always a tough one. But even a deficit, you know, sometimes you run a deficit. So what is the threshold of the deficit that isn't going to prompt us to all of a sudden make some drastic cuts when, in fact, you know,
trends are going to show us that that deficit will be gone in a year. You know, be a surplus of, you know, double that for the next year. So I think in setting thresholds of both surplus and deficits allow you to, you know, be a little bit more in control of your of the finances.
Go ahead, Mark.
I'd be a little reluctant. So one of the reasons that our reserve fund is built up is that every now and then, like, an apartment complex will sell and we'll have a windfall, but it's a one-time. It's not a – it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years. So that could trigger, oh, we're above what we're going to spend. My approach has been one that I just stole from Ryan and Pam and everybody, the other people that were here before, which – the one-time revenues, the windfalls, just kind of set that aside and then use that for those one-time expense-type opportunities and not live off them if you can avoid it. Now, we did dab into that during the recession, and luckily, because we'd allowed that to get as large, the surplus, the rainy day fund, whatever you want to call it, we had built it up as we'd put one-time. We knew there's going to be expense. There's always going to be expense. We could spend that money, but we tried to look at the revenues, the ongoing revenues, ongoing expenses, keep those sort of in line and budgeted. And then we did dip into that a little, and we've still managed to find opportunities to build it back up as those one-time revenues come in and we don't live off them. We just put them back in there.
And I think we're seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
Surplus is good. Don't get rid of the surplus. You know, don't just, you know, oh my God, I'm going to surplus and spend it. But what is the right amount that we want to have?
We've had some discussions like that. Somebody will say, hey, you know what, anything over $2 million is too much, spend it. And we had those conversations.
Well, we haven't had them in the last 4 years.
I mean,
that's why I put that up there is, I mean, I think we need to have a conversation. What is our policy? We've got $7 million in reserves now. What is our rainy day fund of that? Is it $2 million, $1 million, $3
million? And I also think you have to, get through the capital process because one of the things we haven't done is take our, we just tend to use the term reserves, but yeah. We don't segregate that out. That's operating reserves, capital reserves. So we don't really know what needs to go where. And I think we really haven't identified things like equipment, vehicles. We dabbled here and there and said, okay, well, we bought this car and we'll know we'll have to replace it in 5 years, but we kind of have maybe a third of the fleet in terms of equipment and tools that we kind of sort of plan for. So I think the capital plan is really important to identify what our reserve categories are and then our reserve thresholds. I also think we have to not be afraid to use more sophisticated financing opportunities out there. So as we develop something we've never had before, like a true vehicle and equipment replacement plan, you know, we may not want to buy everything pay as you go. We may want to use leases. You know, the fire department doesn't go out there and pay cash for every fire truck it buys in a year, right? Because you want to kind of think through, okay, well, what's the best return for us on these investments? And so I think from my perspective, one of the things I want to see come out of the capital planning is more sophisticated financial planning, too.
You hit on what I was getting at with the other posted about, I forget, what was the one was on the reserve policy, the other one was on the one-time revenue for how'd I word it?
The one-time revenue. revenue streams slash events.
Yeah, and so what I was thinking there is, like, do we want to dedicate REIT revenue to a certain capital fund and dedicate one-time sales tax revenue to another? I think you were alluding to that. I don't know that we have any policy or strategy or objective set, and so I think it's just worthwhile to have a conversation.
I would be reluctant to, being flush with cash is probably a good problem to have. I wouldn't see the need to put caps on or set amounts of how much you can save. I mean, how long and how quick does the economy spin around where you're $1.8 million in debt like we were just recently? So, I'd say keep it running. If you have flush cash, let's make proper investments, whether it's land or partnerships. But, yeah, keep the train rolling.
But one of the interesting things was, like, during the recession, other cities were laying off police officers, and we were hiring because we had the surplus, the cash in the bank, to maintain our quality of service. But I think a lot of our surplus, so-called surplus or reserves, what we actually have is going to be determined by what Gina finds in the roads and stormwater, because we don't have a clue yet what our CIP is going to be.
Yeah, I think you've had half the story so far, the reserve bank account, but we haven't had that other half of the story, which is all the repairs, and I don't think you're going to have big reserves for a really long time. But to your point, you have reserves, but you won't have excess on, non-dedicated reserves. I think to your point, though, I think it is valid. Again, as you look at categories, I wouldn't use it so much by fund, because I think you really want to look at in a given year, and this is why the financial planning is so important. For 2020, what are our total capital projects? What are our total capital dollars? What's our delta, and how are we going to make up that delta, or how are we going to move the plan? But I think to Councilmember Steckler's point, in the finance world, government finance world, you do look at surplus, and you do look at potentially what you want that cap to be, assuming all other issues are funded, because it gets to a point where taxpayers say, if you have that much cash, then you should give some back. There's kind of a fundamental feeling in government that, yes, you should have reserves, yes, you should fund your long-term needs, your short-term needs, but then you get to a point that if you're still having that much excess, then, okay, we need to adjust. In terms of what the taxpayer, and that's not just here. I mean, that's just kind of a fundamental philosophy. That being said, you've been operating with just working on your operating budget and really not the work we're doing now in the capital budget. And so when those numbers come in, I think the surplus conversation will be kind of a moot point. We'll be looking for additional dollars to fund the next 15, 20 years of needs.
I support in what you just said. I do think it's worth reiterating what Pam just hit on. For folks that weren't up here or in staff in 2008 to 2011, it got pretty nasty. Nobody up here, I wish I could tell you I saw it coming. And that's why I was making the decisions that I made. And you put a nice little statue up there. But Terry Ryan and Mary Kay and some of the former council members that were Jack Start, very conservative in their approach, and staff, very conservative. Our fiscal, they would, Lanny would, very conservative on what he thought the revenues would be, a little higher on the, and so we did build up a reserve fund that allowed us to hire police officers, to give raises to staff when the sheriffs or the county and other cities were gutting planning commissions or the Tom Rogers position. They were laying people off all over the place. And when there's a mass exodus in those jobs like that where talented people are now looking, that's not the time to lose your job and be looking. I mean, that was a rough time for a lot of good people. And our staff survived it relatively unscathed, even with some modest pay raises, because we were very conservative, staff and the council, in our spending and having a rainy day fund, a surplus, whatever you want to call it, of nearly 1 year of expenses. So I think there's time to spend it. We're going to be spending it, and it would be, I think it'll be proper, but it's just good to remember. Sometimes those ugly times come, and you don't see them coming. We did not see it coming.
Yeah, along with that, when you talk about a threshold, just because we have a threshold of X doesn't mean we need to spend the threshold of X. But I think we should have an idea of what type of threshold do we need to another 2008 will come. It's, I'm old enough. I've seen a bunch of them up and down. We're going to get another one. It'll come down again sometime. And we need to have a threshold that we can count on. When people say, why do you have that? Well, because we're being fiscally responsible that when it does go down, we're not going to be cutting police officers, firemen, and other services to you. So, but we just need to know what that surplus, what that threshold is, and can explain it. That's just smart. And I think that we definitely do not want to get rid of the surplus. We don't want to run.
And I'm not hearing that. Yeah. And I'm not even saying that, we could have probably, in hindsight, survived it with about a $3 million surplus and not necessarily five. Given what we took and then put back and took and put back, but
this would be a great dialogue to have. But the excess surplus, if you want to even call it that, it creates a lot of pleasant options for the city. So I mean, I think that's a good, comfortable position to be in when many cities weren't.
I think Rebecca's going to be right that when we see the CIP and the state of our infrastructure, this isn't going to be a problem. Good discussion, but
I just want to throw in: Be careful of saying excess surplus, because people have come down here before and said, gosh, why are you guys having a 1% tax increase when you got $5.5 million in the bank? And the reason is $5.5 million in the bank because we need this amount of working capital, this amount of rainy day fund, and this nebulous, a couple of million bucks for our roads we don't quite know, but Scott Smith has said it was on order of $1 million a year. You better start saving. So we've kind of had this nebulous, we better hang on to it. But that doesn't fly when it comes time to say, why are we doing a 1% tax increase? And none of the money we've got in the bank, the surplus or deficit, we can't run deficits, so the surplus we've got is different than running operationally as a deficit. And so you got to remember, too, there's two different kinds of money here. But anyway, this is a good discussion to have. I would love to have this. I've pushed for this over the years to how you want to do it. But I'd love us to at least philosophically segment and understand this much money is needed for the fact that property taxes go like this and Peggy's got to make payroll consistently all year long. There's a certain amount of working capital. There's a certain amount of rainy day fund. And just know that what that number is, it's got to be X million dollars fundamentally just to make this business keep running and not have to shut the doors and send people home. Then on top of that, these other things are really money for future capital purchases or capital strategic stuff. Yeah, strategic stuff. And then we know that, so like the council right before I got on it somehow knew they had enough money to pay cash for the building next door. I don't know that they did a lot of financial analysis, but they had enough money to say it's a good deal, let's buy it. Well, so they had the money on hand to do a strategic investment. I think it's going to get tougher for us to do that in the future, but we need to know how we're going to pay for these things.
Well, and I think that's a really important point because that goes back to the age of the city, right? So it's young, lots of land to develop, cash is coming in. Yeah, that's easy financial management. This is much harder because now the city has matured and pretty much it built out with the few opportunities here and there. And you're having to create a different type of revenue stream than just development dollars, right? That's the tourism initiative. But when you actually have to manage the budget, project the cash flow, monitor your liquidity, plan your capital investments, that's much harder and takes a lot more effort.
Right,
I think I hit every concept. Did I miss anybody? All right. Okay, customer service. Greg, do you mind helping with this one?
Sure. I mean, no, I don't mind. Sure, I will.
No, I don't. Okay. Out of the retreat when we talked about this, obviously you came up with the goal statement, the focus statement, to provide excellent service to all who interact with the city by recruiting, training, and retaining a skilled, innovative, and dynamic workforce. And I thought this was really important, one, because it's something that affects every department or impacts every department. You know, I love excellent service because that's a philosophy of excellence that we want to instill throughout all of our departments. Obviously, investing in our workforce is key to executing this. It goes to lean, it goes to culture, it goes to the STAR values. And out of that retreat and those guiding principles, we kind of came up with Mill Creek at your service. And, you know, you see that in the big letters in the lobby as you walk in on the overbeam. You know, Greg's incorporated it into the police cars. You'll see it written on the cars, at your service. And I think that is something that we really try to instill. I think Greg's done a great job balancing kind of that the warrior mentality of police training with the guardian mentality, with the, you know, being at your service, the community policing. And I think one of our really shining examples in the city is what Peggy and Jody have done on the passport side. I get such tremendous emails on that service, which I think is kind of phenomenal when you spend 2 or 3 hours, you know, maybe on a Saturday waiting for a service, and yet you're still so blown away by the service that you'll take the time to write an email and compliment them. I get a lot of those, and I try to share those intermittently as I get them. But that's the level that we want throughout the city, or we've tried to infuse throughout the city since we came up with the guiding principles. So I'm certainly interested to see what you guys continue to think about this goal, but also where you see taking it. Vanna with the letters.
That's right. Thank you.
Cheers all the way over.
Of course. Takes time to decipher that hieroglyphic handwriting.
What time?
Right in the middle of the afternoon. Right
yeah,
now.
That's usually the worst.
I came down just because I wanted to see. It was so well handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes a lot to, as a customer service representative. Yeah, it takes a lot to manage crowds, cranky people, waited a long time. You know, they do it. That staff does an amazing job.
Hmm? Language difficulty.
Language, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you have families going up getting six passports.
Yes.
We need to open a concession stand.
I know, we thought about it. That's where we're going to sell our T-shirts.
Oh, he's going for their stomachs. Sandwich while they're waiting.
Mm-hmm. They'd be less grumpy if they have to wait.
Have a food cart outside.
That's right,
a
food truck. Mm-hmm. Actually, I would have taken advantage of that.
You think about the example everybody's got, you know, the driver's license office sort of thing. It's if the line is moving promptly, you know what number you are, and the line is moving promptly, and the windows are open, you go, well, I'm here with 100 other people, but it's okay. But the frustrating thing is when each of those 10 windows all starts taking breaks and it gets down to two, then you go like, this is just killing me. So it's the
standing up there, not waiting anybody.
Or like just being transparent and open and just everybody, I'm getting my fair turn, even though it's busy. John was happy because even though he picked a busy time, it was everybody's working and doing a good, efficient job as opposed to what they expected.
And what I love is that the staff is really focused on that continuous improvement philosophy. So, you know, we were so busy on Saturdays, we would get to the end of the day and we couldn't address everybody. Some people got turned away and we couldn't process. So they really got to a point where they didn't have to turn anybody away. So that was the first step. But now they're really working on improving the experience. So how do we implement a triage system? How do we do certain things so that we can cut that wait time down and make the experience better? But I think that's great. You know, the staff is very proud of that and owns that and wants, you know, has real ownership in making that like the best passport experience in the state.
All right.
Hey.
Categorize those as efficiently as I can.
Okay.
We'll start up here. This is about kind of the essence of excellent service. Citizens deserve good service. It's why we're here. And then being, I incorporated being a good partner because that community partnership is what's important. And then continue to create repeat customers. So, you know, a lot of relationship building things in that little group remind us why we're here, what we're, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's passports or, you know, traffic enforcement out on the street. Discussion on that?
One of the reasons I was touching on repeat customers is when I first
got out of the military, I worked at Les Schwab Tires, and Les Schwab was an amazing man.
He had a book out there.
Out there, and he tells the dollar story. And his dollar story is all about sharing the wealth with your employees and whatnot. But at the end of the day, he focuses on getting one customer in the door to sell a set of tires is nice, but getting a customer for life is the goal. So, I mean, that's eventually what your goal should always be, is whenever you have a chance to touch somebody that you make it as positive as possible. For that reason alone, the repeat customer is the lifeblood.
Okay. I'm going to go in the middle here. Walk in the customer's shoes. We're here to serve them, not us. So these kind of, you know, dovetail on each other. We are open for business when customers need us to be. Be flexible, open to changes in how we provide the service. Never lose sight of the customer's needs. And don't just meet customer service expectations. Do things that exceed the customer service experience. So relationship building and stepping up our game and exceeding those expectations. Understanding. come in for tires what they're looking for.
One of those was mine, and I think this ties back to some of the comments that Councilmember Mead made on economic development. You know, if someone comes in for a business permit, they get delayed. That's that much time that their business gets open, that they're generating tax revenue. Tell a quick story of an experience I had in a city that will remain unnamed recently, but understand in our business, in the land development and home building, the time it takes for us to get approved delays the time when we can begin construction, which generates sales tax revenue. And then when we finish the project, if we sell it, it generates REIT. And when someone starts building homes, it generates more tax revenue. And then when the home is sold, there's more REIT. And then there's sales tax when the people go to Lowe's. So in this city, we have been having problems where suddenly the time to review a project has been 7 months. And we went in and met with the unnamed city manager and the planning guy, and we're basically told, sorry, there's nothing we can do. You know, so we're paying fees for the service, and we're not getting the service. And we're like, you're telling us you have budget issues. Well, if you can get our projects approved, we'll generate tax revenue for it. But anyway, I was kind of blown away by the mindset. Fortunately, we don't have that, but we can never lose sight of it, because this translates to economic development in most cases, whether it's revenue for passports or business permits or building permits. It all has an economic development component to it.
I think I love that story, and I think going back to what we talked about a little bit earlier tonight, where you're talking about educating the public as far as fiscal responsibility, you know, I think that goes to employees, because they have to see those things to connect the dots. And I know a lot of times in all employee meetings, when I'm talking about fiscal issues, yeah, I can almost see light bulbs go on, because no one's really taken the time to explain how this pertains to this, that pertains to this, that impacts them. So, I mean, I think that's a great story I'd like to share with staff.
And you hit on another point that I know this is a perception in the building industry, and I'm sure it is in other businesses, is there's a perception that the city employees or the governmental employees don't understand the implications of what they do. So they don't understand when, to them, it's, well, I just got to process this paperwork and issue this permit. They don't understand what it means to the business, that it can mean the difference between getting their financing in place or getting their business open. And there's oftentimes a disconnect. On the one side of the counter, they're just doing their job, punching the clock, getting it done, pushing the paper. But to the people on the other side who are paying for the service, it means a whole lot more.
That's where I think personnel management comes in, and why you want to infuse a culture that drives employee engagement, because that then lends itself to efficient processes that make customers happy. You know, it's all connected, right? And so I think that's a great story. I appreciate you sharing that.
I was one of those two, the one on exceed customer expectations. If that's a philosophy that we can all embrace, including us up here and everyone else, you know, what can we do that nobody's expecting from us? That goes so far towards solidifying great customer service. Your example is the king of it. Les Schwab has done this since the beginning. I mean, running out to people's cars.
Mm-hmm.
We never expect you to run out to our car. We know you'll just be there when we walk in the door. That's all. That'd be great customer service if you're waiting behind the counter when we walk in and we don't have to wait.
But no, right through passport service.
Or some of the things you're doing now with brakes and other things. Whatever you can do that people don't expect, and if we have a mentality of that, and we can celebrate those things and think of those things and, you know, celebrate the people that come up with them, but what could we do that nobody's expecting from us,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have to do? That's great customer service.
Mm-hmm.
One more point, and this hits on the point you made that with the driver's license. I think it's setting realistic expectations, because I think back 30 years ago when I first got my driver's license, they didn't have the numbers and everything, so you just sat there going, when am I going to get called?
Mm-hmm.
At least now you can see, and it's much more efficient, you can see where you're at, and it sets an expectation so you're not as frustrated if it takes a little longer than you expected, because you at least see it's moving along. So if you set the customer's expectations, I think you can avoid a lot of problems.
Yeah. I guess I'd also like to see us, as part of the education, educating the residents, let them know what a good job that we're doing. I just think that we are doing a good job, and people need to be proud of their government, proud of their city, and so when we have an opportunity, that would be a nice thing to do.
Well, I think you have to celebrate your successes. That's how you build a team, and good teams celebrate successes. And you have to own your mistakes, you know. And so, you know, everybody here is human. Our customers are human. People make mistakes. I think the difference is, do you own up to them and fix them when you do?
I'm not sure how it plays in, and maybe it's one of the stickies, but it occurred to me as we were talking how critical somewhat of our role is in this, but the management team, you know, the attitude that Greg brings to the police department and what his sergeants in law enforcement, my experience has been the most important individual is the sergeant, because that man or woman sets the tone for, and if she's looking out for a crew and that crew knows she's got their back and she's helping with training and everything else, they, if they're not terribly flawed human beings, they will go out and do a good job. They will provide good service. They're backed up by their leadership, which starts at that sergeant and then works up ultimately to him, then to you, and some weird level us. But customers, who's the customer service people? Who's the public interaction? It's not many of us. I mean, maybe a little bit of Rebecca as the face of the city at a level, but it's the people that work for you guys and at some level work for us. And what can we do to make sure those people's needs are getting met? And a great example of a huge victory in this exact area is what you just did with the negotiations and the contract. That's spot on type stuff that wins these, that emboldens these employees to hopefully go out and say, you know, I got people care about me and they value me and they show it to me in my paycheck, in my evaluations, in my training, in my equipment. They want me to be safe as I do something that might be somewhat risky. So,
and it's all 2 years makes though. I mean, mass exodus.
But, and I think it's a balancing act, right? You certainly want to take care of your employees by providing them the tools to do the job, and the tools are different depending on the job. Maybe police cars, it may be computer terminals, you know, whatever the case, and you create expectations. I think one of the challenges that, you know, for management teams in government is you don't have the incentives you do in the private sector, right? You don't own a part of the company. You know, there aren't necessarily rewards for performance. It's rewards for longevity. How long have you been here, as opposed to necessarily what have you done while you've been here? And so you're trying to create a culture of excellence, a culture of productivity, an engagement level where people feel ownership in the company, the municipal corporation. And I would submit that is one of the more difficult arenas in management to be in is in the public sector, because you don't have all the tools in the private sector. And so I think it is a big win when you can get employees engaged and you can get teams developed and execute the philosophy.
Understanding what the employee needs. You know, if you've got and paying attention. So I worked for a guy who would point out all the flaws and any mistakes were made. And I said, you know, I don't mind you pointing out my flaws, but could you at least give a little attention to my successes as well? And his response was, it's not my job to point out your successes. It's my job to hold you accountable for your failures. That's flawed. That's a very flawed, broken management stuff. As opposed to saying, hey, you know what? I'd like to see you step it up over here, but nice job over here in this area. There's people out there that if the chief comes by and says, hey, Smith, I noticed you're in the school zone. Well done. Well, good job. Keep up the good work. The city manager said she drove by, saw you out talking with the kids. That guy's going to be there every day because he liked the feedback and he knows someone's paying attention and cares enough to comment on it. And that's, I guess you would think that that's the norm, but it's not.
It's not. And the reality is, you know, financial incentives and rewards are short-lived. It's the day-to-day pat on the backs, recognition, thank you. And we talk a lot about this philosophically as a leadership team, that we want an employee recognition and appreciation system, but it's not just about the things in that system. It's about the day-to-day thank you for doing this. Thank you for a job. It's that interaction that is so important. I completely agree with you.
Just a little quick perspective on the discussion. I mean, we're talking about this objective. We're not talking about bringing it up from a subpar level to acceptable. We're talking about maintaining and enhancing. I mean, a perfect example of how good the staff is doing, I'm going to share the example from today. I got a call from the president of the Little League this morning. Brian, the lights on the third baseline are out, and I hear they might not be replaced until you guys redo the lighting in the field. If we can't have those lights, we can't have games at night. We can't have our concessions. Left a voice message for Rebecca. I didn't hear from her until before the meeting. I went in and said, where are we at? Oh, Nathan went out this morning and fixed them. I called the president. The Little League say, hey, they got fixed. And he goes, I know. Brian Davern called me this morning and told me they got fixed. I mean, they're our customer. They are a lessee of our facility. So just an example of what we're already doing. So I'm glad that we're having this conversation in the context of maintaining and making it better going forward.
And if I could real quick, I think it's interesting that so much of this customer service discussion ended up in the area of employee relations, right, and how we work with each other. And it's always important to remember that there's internal customers and external customers, and that discussion really represents that. We have to take care of, you know, the sergeant who works for me is my customer in a certain way, and so and I'm his, and his or hers in a certain way. So that there has to be that relationship. And, you know, that's kind of, as I looked at how I did this, and then I'll rearrange them because it doesn't make any sense, but it's all about communication relationships. And so we talked a little bit about the communication and listening in two-way, and then the relationship piece is, you know, there's things in here about monitor and survey clients and or customers for satisfaction. We want to hear from them. We want to communicate with them. Always evaluate what you're doing. Are we doing this as well as we can? Let's go hand in hand. Educate the public regarding the diversity of the city staff. So we have that, again, that communication. This is who we are as folks. And then create a hero statue of exceeding customer expectations. I think, you know, wow, how cool is that? Let's really celebrate that. So that's kind of that communication piece.
I do think that's a really important point, though, because there are internal customers, and they are important. You know, the council is a customer of mine, in a sense, right? So you expect certain information. For me to provide that information, I need certain information from department heads. You know, there are internal customers. You know, there's, in order to get people paid, we need, you know, systems at work. We need people to fill out their time cards. I mean, there's lots of internal customers, and they are just as important as those external customers, you know, because it's what keeps the whole system going. I think that's a great point.
So that kind of that two-way feedback piece in that corner, and then this is a lot of the same. Create a suggestion system to uncover new ways to exceed customer service and reward people, and then look for other services we can provide similar to passports that have revenue streams. So, you know, that continuous improvement. What else can we do out there? I like this one. Continue to expand on the chief's police presence in the communities. I'm all over that. Let's go now. Let's take a walk down Main Street. And our actions, parentheses, requirements are all based on jointly held values and priorities. And so, you know, as an elected body, you represent your constituents in this role, and we, a whole community needs to have that, you know, jointly held value system at your service, right? That's why we put that on the police cars and posted it up here, because that's who we want to be. We feel that's a jointly held value throughout the whole place.
You know,
So that last one was mine, and I coupled it with service with a smile. You know, you'd like to have every interaction be with a smile from us, and everybody go like, I enjoyed that interaction. Well, when your cops pull somebody over to give them a ticket, they're not necessarily going to be really happy. But if everybody fundamentally feels that this was an important value in the community, was to be safe and courteous, and so if you're a jerk as a driver, I deserve it. You know, and I go away from that interaction and go, well, maybe this is my favorite thing because I got a $100 ticket, but I get it. And I think if everybody is focused on those values and priorities, then there's a substantiation of why we're doing it, you know, you can kind of understand. Again, it's kind of set the expectations. Because you'd like everybody to go, like, every interaction I have with the city is pleasant, and they're not all going to be your favorite thing. You know, coming in and get your passport really quick, that's cool. Getting your permit done really quick, that's cool. Going to extravaganza, that's really cool. Getting a ticket, not so cool. But you still feel like, well, they did it in a courteous fashion, and I understand why they weren't being a jerk about it. That's fair. So that's what I was trying to get at there.
Well, I think that's good. It also touches on something else we talk about a lot, right, walking in the other guy's shoes. And I think one of the things that's important is to walk in the shoes of the employee. Because we talk a lot about walking in the customer's shoes, but if you subscribe to the theory of internal customers, it is important to walk in the shoes of the employee, you know, who they encounter, how people treat them. Because I can assure you, interactions that some employees have sometimes with the public are very different than the interactions you have. And you have to kind of appreciate that and understand what they're up against on a regular basis sometimes.
Rebecca, I really wanted to call out something. You ever give up the idea, I think that's brilliant, what other services can we come up with that we haven't thought about that would be a service to the community that could give us that same opportunity? That's a great idea. That is a great idea. I think that's a way to generate revenue, create better customer service, exceeding expectations. That's a real strong one.
And, you know, I also think back, remember, we did a lot of changes to improve passports. We changed our space. We changed the hiring structure. We changed the staffing and scheduling structure. We changed the hours. We did a lot of things to make it better and develop it as a better business model for the city. But remember the pain we went through with all those changes. That was hard for employees. Now we're getting to a point where people are starting to see some of the benefits from the changes, and that's helpful. It's not always easy for people to understand 2 years in advance what we're doing then to benefit us 2 years down the road. So I think that's just important to reflect on.
I think this one touches also a little bit on what I talked about with fiscal responsibility and the public confidence. I put up diversity up there partly because of the recent conversations and discussions we've heard from the public in our selection process. And I think the public is unaware of the diversity we already have within the city employees. I mean, Greg is the odd man out at the table tonight.
Yes.
We have quite a bit of diversity, but in addition to that, I don't think the public realizes, and it goes to the relationships, how many of you, and not that it's a prerequisite, but you guys live in the city. I mean, it's not just a job. It is your community, too, and I think that helps build the relationship and level of trust that the public has in what we're doing and what you are doing.
What's even, I think, cooler, that's not really a word, more impressive, because we're not focused on quotas, every one of these people is here because they were the best qualified person, not because of their gender, not because of their skin color, because their skill set was better than everybody else they were up against.
I don't know if we've gotten to mine yet, so I'm just going to skip ahead, I think, a little bit. I didn't want to leapfrog it, but we're kind of encompassing all of that.
That's good.
You are, yeah.
So it is the next spot we're headed.
Yeah, well, I mentioned the your tour out there or in the community. I also put an employee of the month kind of suggestion, and also our magazine that we have doing bios. We did a bio on city council members, but doing a bio on staff, picking certain months where we have our staff, and it goes along with talking about diversity of the staff. It's kind of showing who the people are that's providing the services, celebrating those successes, like our mayor said, because we have had a lot of successes. Councilmember Vaughn's talking about the contract negotiations. Unless people are here in the audience watching and hearing you talk about the contract negotiations and what went into it and how big of a success that really was, nobody knows that the city is now saving a bunch of money because of something that you've done really well. And so to highlight something like that in a bio type thing, or I don't know if the city manager ever gets employee of the month or whatever, one of those types of situations where we're celebrating the wins, mm-hmm. and also using that opportunity to introduce the staff to the public in a way that we do with council members. The council members could be the face, and so we want to publicize that. Well, why not do that with staff that.
Mm-hmm. that
traffic daily, but that are behind the scenes doing, you know, providing all of the services.
No, that's okay. It's next evolution. And so I'll just talk about those staff bios in the newsletter magazine. I think that's a, you know, it's a great idea. And then the employee of the month are the two things that Councilmember Mead mentioned. But, you know, it's we should shamelessly market ourselves at every opportunity. You know, I believe that 100%. We should celebrate our successes and shamelessly market ourselves because we're doing great things. And that, I think that's kind of what you're talking about. We're doing really good things, and we owe it to the people who pay our salaries. It's their money to say, look at what we're doing with what you're providing here. In the same group is recognize, honor employees for creativity and job well done. And this is just a little bit different, but it's properly staffed, trained, and equipped to provide the services required. And so we talked a little bit about internal customers and making sure that we treat them such. The folks that are doing the job, the people that are, you know, at the counters or on the streets or whatever, making sure that they have, you know, kind of what they need. So that's kind of a you know, take care of the people that take care of the people kind of area there.
I think, too, you know, I see evolutions of things. So I like the insert that we had in Mill Creek Living, we did like employee profiles, like what you're talking about. Now we kind of evolve those and try to really not just talk about the employee, but, you know, successes they have as an employee that benefit the citizens. So I really like, you know, what you were saying, your train of thought. So in this last issue, City Connections, you know, we did Nathan Lerma and Bagheera. And so we talked about the canine unit and highlighted Nathan and all his training. And, you know, and that's good because it gives the employee a sense of accomplishment and recognition, but it tells the community who this employee is and what cool thing they've done to help them as a community. So I like that kind of train. We're going to try to keep that going.
It's just
but it's that continuous improvement where we used to do just a little profile, and now we've just kind of expanded it. So it triggered that for me. So always looking for ways, you know, to recognize. And also we did a survey actually with our employees and things that they want to do. And we used to do like an employee of the year. It was hard to kind of do an employee of the month because we have so few, we kind of ran through everyone. but they were like looking for, they want to do, you know, less of the annual recognitions and more of the fun things like going to a game as a group. And so we're working on changing up the recognition or program a little bit. And that's continuous improvement because we did something for a couple years and now we're changing, keeping it fresh.
So along the lines of continuous improvement, I kind of left this here off by itself because with all of our communications and relationships and customer service and feedback and all of the things that we're doing, we want to establish a level of performance management expectations for those services and then review that. So that's a big piece of how we get to that continuous improvement. Let's do all of these things and then have some measurement in place to see how well we're doing what we're doing.
I don't know who did that one, but whoever did gets a gold star because I think that's a really important part of the strategic planning process is that performance management. It's also a really important part of our continuation of building a culture here that performance management isn't viewed as something where, oh, they're reviewing that to see if I did my job or didn't do my job, but they're reviewing that to see how can we improve, you know, always looking to that continuation. It reminds me growing up, my mother, I swear, said it 50 times a day, your reach should always be higher than your grasp, you know, and I hated it as a teenager, but it has stuck with me my whole life, and I think, to me, that's kind of what continuous improvement is about. You're always reaching higher than you're grasping at the moment. And so I think performance management fits right in with that.
And to Councilmember Bond's point about the, you know, Sarge, you said you're doing, here's what you're doing wrong instead of what you're doing right. It's all how we do it. It's, you know, that's the key again. And that so that you take this thing that you're doing and incorporate all this because it has to be done right. It has to be presented properly and set the expectations ahead of time. And, you know, that's just what that's our job, right, to try and do those kinds of things to make sure we do it properly. But it's vitally important at the end of the day. how are we doing what we're doing?
Yeah, it was an interesting point Councilman Vaughn brought up, because when you talk about high achievers, people that the kind of people we want to emulate, what motivates them more than anything else is when they're being told what they're doing right. That they realize they work hard, they really care, and it's being recognized. And the greatest motivator is when they're doing it right.
So never tell them.
High achievers are getting the least amount of encouragement possible and the most amount of frustration and, you know, lack of desire to try. So, yeah, I agree with that. It's telling people when they're, you know, this is what we expect of you and you're doing it. Those people will just try to do more because now they know they're being seen and they're being recognized.
I think that wraps that.
I got a weird thought. Listen to us talk. So we've identified that this goal, the way it was written, is provide excellent service to all who interact with the city. And so that made it external customers. And so we had this discussion about internal customers, which is also relevant. So I'm wondering if maybe there's a different goal, or maybe we've put too many things together. That's a discussion for another time. And what we've talked about here is the customers who are the citizens or the people who visit Mill Creek. And I love talking about walking in their shoes and making sure the city are a service organization. That's the only reason we exist, is to serve our citizens, and they own this corporation. But we've got this funny thing that we've forgotten about, or at least not forgotten about, but you guys have to deal with every day, is there's a lot of compliance stuff. There's a lot of stuff you guys have to do who are also your customers, because they are recipients of processes. You guys do processes and have an output, and it goes to them. It's the state, whatever, this and that. There are customers, too. We didn't talk about that. But it's also, it's hit me. It's part of the frustration, because we could run an excellent customer service organization in terms of the citizens and the people who visit our city, but it's those state agencies that are asking you guys to do stuff are also part of that process. And you'd like them to go, oh, Mill Creek's easy to deal with, but it's also really tough. For you guys to do that and feel good about it, because they're not going to tell you you did a really good job. They're not going to help you improve your process to make it better, because they've got all these things that are common for all the cities or whatever, and they're not going to change them. So that's a tough environment to work in. We're asking your employees to do both of those things well. It's tough.
Well, and two, sometimes what one customer wants negatively impacts another customer, mm-hmm. right? So the state auditors may say, we want you to do something this way, but that may negatively impact our employee performance, program. But that wording of all who interact with the city actually bubbled up from staff, because they brought up that very thing. There are certainly our citizens, right? But there's our businesses, there's our partners like the school system, there's regulatory agencies, it's our internal folks, our employees, it's everybody who interacts with the city in one way or another. Now, what we may have done is really kind of lost sight of that word all.
We had a long discussion about that at the retreat at the country club. I remember that, about using that word because of that, because we talked about all the different constituencies we had to deal with. So that, I recall that word being very intentional on our part.
And that's good. I'm just thinking, we got to got done with all our sticky notes, and it didn't occur to me until I heard somebody else say something. This is the benefit of brainstorming. I was like, oh, gosh, none of mine, and probably none of anybody else has talked about.
That's a great point. I put on the sticky note, being a good partner, and in essence, that's exactly what that means, is whether you're working with the school district, whether you're working with the library, whether you're the representatives with the police guild, fire district, on and on. You have your role to play. So, I mean, that's just as important a customer service skill as anything else we provide. So that's where I was kind of going with the.
And I think, what Councilman Todd alludes to is very true. A lot of times in a single day, we will deal with multiple customers with competing interests. And what we may do that makes this customer really happy makes this one really unhappy. And that is kind of a constant internal struggle for staff, management, on a regular basis. I think it's one of the things that makes government unique, in that sense, because you have so many diverse customer groups.
So Brian left, but it's the development guy wants to come to the permit counter and get done quickly and get on with it. And we understand that, but that darn Department of Ecology says, mm-mm. You got to jump through these hoops, and it's going to take a long time.
Maybe the developer got his tree permit really easy, you know, and cut down the trees, and then the citizen came and complained because we let them cut down the trees, right? You know, so you have those things that are constantly going on and you're balancing.
Okay. Next week we next week we do recreational opportunities and public safety. So next up on our agenda is the construction management services conference.
Thank you. First of all, Council, I'd like to congratulate all of you because today the 35th Avenue project went out for solicitation of bids. And so I know this is a project that all of you worked on long before I got here or any of us got here. So today was a big milestone day where it actually went out for bid. So I just wanted to share that success with you. Last week, you approved an agenda item we added for an H&H study. And I wanted to have Gina kind of walk through the results of that. That was completed. That was kind of a last piece after her review of the project when she came on board with city. We felt like we needed before we let it out for bid. You know, I think, and again, I wasn't here through 95% of this design project, so I have only kind of what I've been told. But what I perceived is that the expectation was you were doing this project so the road would no longer continue to settle and to deal with the flooding on 35th as a result of that settling. So I think, you know, Gina astutely identified that one of the things we really didn't have in the file is what the expectations are for flooding with this new design. And so that's really a lot of what the H&H study is about, is to identify that, because I think it's important, rather, from a communication standpoint, that we clearly set expectations about what this project is designed to actually do. So in your file folder on your desk is the results of the H&H study. And Gina, do you want to just kind of briefly go through that before we get into the rest of the agenda item?
So thanks, Rebecca. So one of the things when I started 4 months ago, I started looking at the PS&E, the plant specs and estimates, and where they were at. Clearly, the geotechnical was handled in a very transparent way. I was able to backtrack and look at the pin piles and how they were selected and the borings that were done. And in my mind, I felt confident that as far as the settlement of the road, they had handled that from a design perspective. So that was one of the aspects. But then there's the functionality of the road. Living in the area, I'm familiar with the frequent flooding. And so started looking at the H&H, the hydrological and hydraulic memo, and there were some areas that I felt were not covered or addressed or documented properly. I worked with the design team trying to look at how decisions were made, mostly for the elevation of the road, which is critical for flooding purposes, and decided, and that's why we came to you last week, to, instead of backpedaling and looking back, looking forward and doing this exercise to address future potential flooding. And so this is the packet that you have here in front of you. I will say, I don't know which is the first page that you have. Is that the one that you have?
Probability.
Is it the blue?
Probability chart.
Okay. So I'll probably get to that table in just a little bit. I will start off with your first diagram, which is probably the one that has more blue. Okay. So this is a printout of what's called a HECRAS model, and that's an acronym for a program that was developed originally for the Army Corps of Engineers. It is the most common model used for H&H, again, hydrological and hydraulic analysis. It's been around for more than 20 years. So that is what our design consultants are using, perfectly, it's kind of best management practices. The model is very good. It has some limitations, but still it provides good information. They are developing, as part of the amendment that you approved last week, a memo, a stamp memo that will tell the story. So what I'm going to share to you with you today is just a brief overview of what's going to be captured in that memo. This diagram, these cross sections, actually they're profiles that show more blue, they're representing the existing roadway. So if you were to look at the roadway, if you're standing on the east side of the road, And if you looked at the profile, the crown of the road, that's what this diagram represents. So on your left side, that would be the south limit of the project, and on your right side, that would be the north limit of the project. There are two existing culverts, more or less in the center of the project, and so that's what those two kind of oblongs, or they're representing circles, diameters, are there. So as you can tell, there is water, and that's what's representing current flooding. This is for a 100-year flood, so you can do studies for different years as shown on these tables. The consultants looked at more or less three scenarios, so they called it low, moderate, and high. So low is a very, I will call it, ideal situation that's probably not realistic. Moderate is probably more your average, and then high is throwing in more conservative factors. Now, there are some limitations to the model that's just inherent with what we're doing. So, for instance, development that's out there is not represented in the model. Vegetation growth cannot be represented in the model. So, again, those three tables on the left capture the existing conditions under the low, the moderate, and the high. As you can tell, under all three situations, the roadway floods for the 100-year flood. So I don't know if there's any questions about this. You're familiar with the roadway. This is what's happening right now. It floods.
I know for people who may listen to the recording, define what a 100-year flood is. I mean, because I think there's a lot of misperception. It's not something that happens once every 100 years. It's a probability.
Correct. And so that's what the table that's included in your handouts represents. And you're correct, council member. It is not intuitive, and you need a table in order to interpret it. So if you look at your table and where it shows the 100-year flood, which is a common flood year use. Some organizations use 500 or 1,000, but we're using 100 for this exercise. If you look at that table, the column to your right, when it talks about the annual probability, so a 100-year flood in a single year has a 1% probability of happening. That's on a single given year. Now that probability, so now we're getting to probability and statistics, increases as the years go by. So if you look further right on that table, still under the 100-year flood, over a 10-year period, a 100-year flood has a 10% probability of happening. After a 25-year period, you have a 22% probability of happening. And a 100-year flood, after 100 years, has 63% probability of happening. So a 100-year flood doesn't necessarily mean that it will happen once in 100 years. It's really, for insurance purposes, there's probability statistics that have been included. So it's not that straightforward. So that's why we included this table in this package, because it helps provide that clarity.
Sorry, I'm still a little confused on that. That same, you're talking about this table here, right?
Correct.
Okay. Could you explain that to me again one more time? I'm sorry.
Sure.
I was trying to find the proper table going through that.
Okay. So on the far left column of that table, there's different types of floods. So the 2-year flood, the 10-year flood, the 25-year flood, 50 all the way to a 1,000-year flood.
Does that represent the size and the magnitude?
The intensity of the flood, yes. So what we're using in this HECRAS model is the 100-year flood. You could use a 500 or a 1,000. So for instance, in Texas, the flood that happened in September of last year, that was more of a 500-year flood.
Isn't something like 90% of our rain events, or is it 10 years or less, or is it 2 years or less?
90%?
Yeah, I mean, there's some, the vast majority are the smaller, the 2 or 10 year.
2 to 10 year,
right.
Yes.
This is 2 to 10 is what we are for, is it correct?
Correct. Those are more frequent. For design purposes, we don't design for the 2 or 10 year. We typically look at the 100-year flood. And so that's what's on the left side of the column. You see those kind of intensity of the floods, and that's what those years represent.
The only problem, I have a question on, where's the intensity of the flood?
It's increased by the years. So on the far left, a 2-year flood, for instance, would be a lot less significant than a 1,000-year flood.
This number, that symbolizes the intensity. That's symbolizing the intensity. just 100 and 10, the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like correct.
A and the name down. Of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we covered the current scenario, which is the diagrams, the profiles that show the blue. So again, we're already anecdotally experienced with this because we've seen the roadway flood.
Jeannie, before you go on, would you explain down at the bottom there, you've got the beaver dams plus one, the beaver dams plus two as additional columns, and the bottom one is 100-year flood plus 2 feet of beaver dams. Is that what that is?
Yeah, what that means is when we went out in mid-February and we did a survey of the existing road, we wanted to look at where the beaver dams are right now, knowing that that's static. Beavers can build dams anywhere they want. We did a snapshot mid-February, where are the dams, existing elevation, and shot existing elevations. So in those tables, you will see different columns, and they have the reoccurrence interval, the different years. To the right of that, you'll see without beaver dams, so that's a very ideal situation, it's non-existing. Then you'll see with existing beaver dams, those are the elevations that were shot in mid-February. And then if the beaver if the beavers keep on raising the elevation of their dams, and there's nothing that's done, there's no beaver management plan or maintenance, those are what those elevations are representing, and they went, we went up 2 feet above the existing elevation. So that's
at the dam.
At the dam, as they are today.
Thanks.
Yes.
So, like your example we were just talking about is 4.38 feet.
Yes.
That's the greatest depth of water down to the road, existing roadway, that the beaver dams plus 2 foot increase on 100-year flood. Is that correct? Am I reading that correct?
Beaver dam plus two, yes.
At the deepest spot. The deepest place you would wade would be 4.38 feet up your body when you're standing at a low spot.
From the roadway.
On the roadway.
No.
Yes.
Don't try.
Amphibious.
So again, this particular scenario, which is an existing scenario supported by what we have seen. The other sheet that you'll see there in front of you shows a lot less blue, thank goodness. And what that shows is the proposed project. So now what we've done is we modeled it with the profile of the proposed roadway of the project that we're advertising today. And again, taking that, you can look at the low, moderate, or high. And if you look at the moderate, which is, you know, a professionally recommended approach, you'll see that on the far right side of that profile, which would be the north end of the project, there is some puddling or flooding, 0.28 feet. So it's less, obviously, as we would expect, than the current roadway, but there is still something that could happen, that could puddle. How much of it and for how long, there's many, again, factors that would contribute to that.
Well, what is the low, moderate, and high referred to again?
So it's the sensitivity of the analysis. So low assumes very ideal conditions. So under ideal conditions, this is the elevation that the flooding that would happen or not happen. Moderate is your average, and then high is assuming worst case scenario. So it's basically scenario studies.
I guess I'm not understanding. What's the variation? What's changing between those? The intensity, because you got the intensity of the storms on here and all the scenarios. So I'm not understanding what's changing.
So then we get it, that's a little bit more detail into what's the input of the HECRAS model. So there's different data that can build up the model, and the level of sensitivity of that data could vary. So
all the inputs are plus or minus 10% or 20% or 30%. This is the roll up of those to say this is.
But in general, what it's doing, it's painting the worst-case scenario, best-case scenario, and kind of like that middle ground.
Have we ever taken shots of the beaver dams when they've been there before? I assume we haven't, to know whether or not they've ever been 1 or 2 feet above what the shots were in February.
In the past?
Yeah. just trying to figure out if we've ever experienced that before, but we've probably never taken shots of those elevations of the beaver dams that have existed there before to know how they would compare to what's there today.
Yeah, I don't know what staff did in the past. I really haven't heard anything about that. But, you know, one of the things I've appreciated, I've appreciated Gina's attention to detail and going back through the project and I think really owning the project, even though she came in at the point where it's getting ready for bid. So I appreciate that diligence. I also appreciate, you know, the approach she's taking, you know, really looking at the beaver dams and the beavers and the impacts. And you'll see in your council planning schedule in May, talking about a program she's bringing forward, beaver management plans, because it really does go to our stormwater management plan. And so she's done some pretty innovative relationship building and has some pretty innovative ideas that we're going to chat about in May.
My recollection, without any substantiation, but maybe Mark can check me on this, I think many years ago, the assumption was we couldn't do anything about those beavers. We were just letting them do it. And then 4, 5, 6 years ago, I remember staff said, gosh, there are a few things we could do. And we started doing a few things when the water was coming up. You know, the road was sinking slowly, but the water was coming up. And at one point, we finally said, look, you got to do something. And so I think they figured out something you could legally do without killing the beavers and without just totally destroying their homes. We did something. And I think there's more that we could do. And so I'm happy to hear. It seems like at some point you got to say, okay, I love the beavers, but
the state does have beaver management rules, believe it or not. There's a set of adopted regulations that the cities or developers or property owners can comply with to control it.
Yeah. And I think at that same time we were more aggressive. I think beaver deceivers got put into Pond 6 over here because it was a non-natural thing. It was easier to deal with. And so I think we got familiar with the concept of beaver deceivers and started talking about it more. And so staff did something, but I don't know exactly because they didn't come to us for approval. They just kind of worked on some. But I think that the answer is I don't think we know exactly because I don't think we were taking good measurements because we were under the assumption for many years we couldn't touch them.
And I think this is just an evolution of the growth and the sophistication, you know, of the city and proactively trying to manage through problems. I also want to give Gina credit. Trust me, she does not just stay in her office to look at this. I mean, I have personally seen her out there on 35th and at the ponds and looking and measuring the beaver. I mean, she, you know, it's been a pleasure. Going, Councilman Bond, to your comment of, you know, these folks are here because they really were the best and the brightest in their subject matter expertise. And I think you're seeing that with what she's discussing and bringing forward here.
Gina, I have a question. Thank you for this. This is good stuff. Totally on board and happy with this project that it's finally moving. So thank you. One of the questions I did have is I know the Corps of Engineers and the tribe had an issue with, I want to say it was water flow through and underneath the roadway. So has that all been addressed?
Yes. We have the Army Corps permit, and that's why we were able to move with advertising today. So that has all been addressed.
To make sure I understand, and I think I do, look at the second diagram with the proposed elevation changes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that, you know, low would not make sense to
build
that, obviously. But moderate might make sense to build to that level of probability as opposed to the high level. So at the moderate level, there is some minimal puddling mm-hmm. predicted. And again, my ignorance, mm-hmm. when I look at that, that's what we want to build to, and I would think that if we want to build 35th out, people know that the issues we've had with this road sinking and the flooding and everything else, how much more difficult would it be, I'm really ignorant here, to build at a moderate level where there would be virtually no problem?
So that's part two of this memo, and I have not received that data yet because I was anticipating exactly this question. Now, the design being at 95% completion, there are very limited things that could be done, and at this point we're talking change order or a future project. One of the things that could have been done, say for the high, the worst case scenario, there on the south end of the project, you do see some puddling with a depth inundation of 0.65 feet. So extending the project limits further south to include that intersection that was one scenario that could have been done. The project does not represent that. That's a change in the direction and the footprint of the project. That's something that usually is done at 30 or 60% design.
Okay, so this is past the stoplight at the office on scene.
No. No, no, no.
It's not. It's within the footprint of the project. What I'm saying is that these worst-case scenarios where they represent flooding on the south end of the project, which is over by intersection 144th, entering the Highland Trails neighborhood, okay, to avoid any kind of flooding in that location, we would have had to extend the project limit further south to include the intersection. The current project as it is does not include intersection improvements. The project starts north of that intersection.
Understood.
Yeah.
So you're still waiting to get the final results as to what other changes could be made to, at a moderate level, ensure no puddling or flooding?
Yes, and at this point, those would be minor improvements. So the part that I feel that I appreciate about this exercise is that it gives us more information. It doesn't necessarily make us feel great about feeling that there will never be any flooding. That is not what this exercise is pointing to. But what it does is it helps us make an informed decision. So we went out to bid, and at some point, hopefully, we will proceed with award, knowing that there is a possible potential puddling or flooding in the future. So it gives us that, empowers us with the information that we need to have. That's the purpose of this exercise, to be aware of that.
And I don't know that the expectation was ever that there would never be any puddling. And I say that because I don't know. This has happened years in the past. But I want to make sure this council has a good understanding and expectation of what has been designed as to what the effects will be.
And as we finish,
my ignorant question then is that, do we build this, everyone knows about it, is it a risk that there is some puddling on 35th and media picks it up,
I think it's about setting expectations.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons for doing this exercise. So Joni and Gina and Greg, they've all been working on a communications plan that we'll be bringing to you when we do our next update on 35th, but that's all about setting expectations. What the road will be, what the construction going on all around us during this construction, traffic routes, there's no way to build this without inconveniencing people. We just need to be clear what the inconveniences are, just as we need to be clear what the ultimate product will be.
So I'm really glad that you are clarifying this, because the expectation was that this would fix it. So if it's not a fix at the level, at least I thought, was problem solved. Not money, but problem solved. So you're saying, sort of.
Well, it's worst case scenario.
Well, and that's where we get into probabilities and statistics.
Right.
So given a certain number of years, we will probably see some level of flooding.
But in extreme conditions, yes. But if we're building the moderate, we should build the moderate with no conditions of flooding.
There are other factors also to consider, and I think that's something for us to discuss, is beaver management. So there's that maintenance aspect for the beaver dam management, for those that the beaver dams that are within the city's property, and then also collaborating with the private property owners that have dams that could affect the scenario as well. So there's that other aspect on beaver management that is not the profile of the roadway, not the traditional engineering, but more looking at the whole system as well.
And you get into then a cost-benefit analysis. Does the cost of a redesign or building it to a level where you want to have absolutely zero puddling really make sense financially? So you're at a $6 million kind of estimate total project design to construction. Again, going back from the previous sheet and looking at all the blue you had and getting down to a potential for this puddling under these conditions. And I think Gina makes an excellent point, is something we really haven't done is that maintenance plan and how our discussion about infrastructure maintenance, you ignore it and it gets worse and it gets worse and it's more expensive, Well, there's an analogy there, too, from a stormwater perspective on the beaver maintenance. You just keep ignoring that, and waters rise, and it impacts your infrastructure. So you got to kind of not just build things, but you have to maintain those things that are impacting your infrastructure.
Is there any risk of the road settling?
I don't believe so. As far as the geotech, everything I reviewed, I feel comfortable. We're going down to the bearing soil, so that's all you can do from an engineering perspective, and we're doing that. We're installing more than 500 pin piles.
So the puddling would impact the use of the roadway, perhaps, but not necessarily result in damage.
Correct.
Good stop. That's
right.
Good.
This is the answer.
Right? Yes. Correct.
It's only a few hours.
Yeah.
In worst case, you're going to have some people running into some levels.
Correct. Worst case scenarios.
And so, you know, if that's the case, then I do agree with you on the expectations up front. You're not going to have to drive over here. You're building a swamp. And you've got beavers that they don't report to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As much as we try.
Way less.
Yes.
Right. I've been driving for about 10 years now. And it's flooded multiple times over the last 10 years that you can't even use the road. That is not going to be happening. It's not going to be flooding to the point where we can't drive the road.
Right. So the functionality of the road should be significantly improving compared to right now we have to close down the road when it floods.
Exactly.
We're talking about puddles, probably on the shoulder. Maybe we need to do a traffic control, reducing to two lanes, worst case scenario. I don't anticipate full road closures, not with this data.
That's
this data is not revealing that.
Yeah, I can't, that's right, that can't be overemphasized. I mean, that's what Sound Transit suffers from, is because the public got this perception that building light rail is going to make congestion go away, which was never the intent of the project. So this is being designed to minimize the risk that we're going to have any significant flooding that's going to close the road. But we need to make sure the public is aware of that there's a risk, there could be, otherwise we're going to get blowback. But the other expectation is the
rock stuff.
This is what people are going to hear 12 hours a day for, and I don't think the citizens appreciate that yet, especially in my neighborhood and Vince's neighborhood and your neighborhood. So we just need to set those expectations. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Sorry, over there. Yeah.
Well,
so we're down, by the way, to the works or the police department, whoever is handling the cones and the road issues out there, because this year's been pretty slick. I mean, well done.
So
very
that was
in getting that addressed.
But
us old guys, you know, in terms of setting expectations, you got to remember that this road was never open for business. I shouldn't say never. It was, you could not count on it being open for business 30 years ago when it was just a farm road that went through a swamp. The county made a decision to build to a certain level to make this into a major north-south thoroughfare, and they chose a certain elevation. And what Gene has done here is great, but to Councilmember Steckler's comments, you know, off the edge of this page, yeah, you could fix the part to the south at the entrance to Highland Trails, but going north, I think you run into other issues where the project doesn't extend a few feet, it extends thousands of feet, because fundamentally the county put it at a certain grade. And so to change that so it would be set for a 500-year flood is a bigger project. I think that's what you're trying to say. So we can never fix this such that Houston won't happen to us. We hope it won't happen, but you know, that's, at some point it will happen, and it won't be 100 years from today. The probability says it can happen 63% in the next 100 years it's going to happen, but that doesn't mean it won't happen next year. So people shouldn't expect that, you know, probabilities are not certainties. That's why you don't always win at the casino. Mark knows that. Even if you get a small advantage on your blackjack, you just don't really win enough, do you? So people have got to understand that this is, number one, it's a huge difference than it was a long time ago. I personally think the beavers have added to this, a lot of other stuff. The water has come up faster than that road has sunk. because the county made that road a lot taller when they put that stuff in the first place. Those of you who were around, remember, they put a lot of truckloads of gravel out there. They put a lot of lightweight fill in there. They didn't put enough some places. They didn't excavate deep enough.
Well, but it wasn't just the setting the elevation. It's they didn't do what we're doing now. They didn't go down to the bearing soils, and that's the big change that we're doing that they didn't.
Yeah, what they did is they dug and they thought, bearing soils further down than we thought. Let's just throw some crap in the hole and go for it. They cheaped out on the project. But
I'll take the 98% fix.
Yeah.
It'll be a vast improvement, immense over the existing conditions.
But again, you cannot guarantee that it will never be a puddle out there.
Right.
It's going to happen.
And that's the reason for the exercise. And I think, you know, it's important. That's our job as staff to make sure you guys have accurate information and can set clear expectations. So I appreciate your indulgence last week of adding the agenda item so we could get this work done, bring it to you this week, and be have a confidence level before we actually release the project for bids. So with that, we get into the agenda item, which is seeking authorization to execute a contract with Gray and Osborne for construction management inspection services for the 35th Avenue Southeast Reconstruction Project in an amount not to exceed $611,300. This construction management services is obviously part of the project. This starts out with an RFQ to really look for the best qualified firm. We had six firms respond to our RFQs. Once you identify the best qualified firm, then you get into actually unit pricing and determining cost. I don't know what the city's experience has been. If you're familiar with why you hire project managers, or if you'd like us to describe that, I know, you know, it's common in projects like when we had water sewer projects, we always had the construction managers. Do you want us, is the council familiar with that, or do we need to go through the purpose of construction management services?
Well, the $600,000 is all built into the cost of the project.
So on page two of your agenda summary, you can see that we have put a total project cost together. One of the things that Gina did after assuming the project was also just do a biddability and constructability cost review. And these are updated numbers for the project based on those reviews.
So you want a motion to?
Well, hang on. But before we I'm reading into the question there. So the 5990 number that's on page two for construction includes this 611 for this one, which is really time and materials, but has a guaranteed max of 611. Is that correct?
Gina? So the 599, that includes the whole entire construction phase, which is the engineer's estimate, meaning what the contractor is going to charge us, and the construction management.
And a contingency. So you just put it out to bid, and we're hoping, we've got our fingers crossed, that it'll come back at 6980. And you got a 10% contingency of 489 plus the 611 here. This 611 is time and materials, but with a guaranteed max, or this is a, what kind of contract is this?
Not to exceed.
Not to exceed?
So in attachment A, where the construction cost estimate is, there's that whole breakdown. So you'll see all the bid items, which is what the contractors will be bidding on. And there's the engineer's estimate at roughly $4.9 million. And then there's a contingency because of an uncertainty factor on these elements. And then there's the construction management and construction administration. That's the $611K. That's the Gray and Osborne contract.
And if you go to exhibit, well, attachment B, which is the Gray and Osborne contract, and exhibit A of that contract, is actually the scope of work. So that's their project management, task, contract administration. These are basically people out there daily inspecting the construction and documenting it.
And a question on that, I was just on that section. You're comfortable with the amount of liability insurance and coverages that they're providing under their responsibility in the scope of the contract?
Yes. Yes.
It's less than the overall, but still quite substantial. So.
And again, that's the contractor will have different insurance. This is just the construction management.
Right. This is there in case they screw up.
the oversight of it, the inspections, right? So the contractor will then have additional insurance requirements.
Okay, that explains my question. Okay, thank you.
So 611 is a max? The question's still out there.
I think what the council
not to
members,
exceed.
It's a not to exceed.
Yes.
Okay. Yep, you know, I've not heard of Grant Osborne before. Is this somebody that obviously we've got good reference on? Are they somebody that we've that done this kind of project before?
It's a firm. They've worked for me in previous roles. The firm is experienced. The project team is very experienced, and that's why we selected them, not because of the firm, but because of the people in the team.
They do most of the historically have done most of the outside engineering for Silver Lake Water and Sewer District.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're pretty long-standing, reputable firm.
I see in their schedule part of this is doing some test piles to understand what that process is. Is there, have these guys done pile driving before?
So the pile driving would be done by
the contractor. But have these guys managed that kind of stuff before?
Yes, and so we have geotech inspection included in the 611K.
This is just the contractor who's overseeing the project?
This, Grant Osborne is a engineering consulting firm. And so there are a group of engineers, including geotech and archaeological service, that will be overseeing the contractor doing the physical construction.
Okay. Making sure they do it according to.
Correct. Inspecting.
If there's no further discussion, what motion would you like?
Just as it's set forth on, flipping pages here on your agenda summary, the motion to authorize the city manager to execute a contract with Gray and Osborne for construction management inspection services for the 35th Avenue Southeast Reconstruction Project in an amount not to exceed $611,300. And I think I mispronounced, is it Gray or Grant?
Gray.
But now I'm confused.
Councilmember Todd has a comment.
Well, you make the motion, but I still got more questions. You're happy to put a motion on the table and I'll discuss it.
So do you have a motion?
I'll make the motion.
And a second?
I'll second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second discussion.
Actually, we're going to need to extend the meeting, like 15 minutes to it.
Are you going to be done?
We're just answering questions at this point, so I think that's...
No, for the rest of the agenda. Meeting, for the rest of the agenda.
This is the only item left, I believe, right? Okay. Oh, well, reports. I'm sorry. You have consent agenda and reports.
Okay, so let's extend the meeting 15 minutes. Motion to extend the meeting.
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? Passed unanimously? Okay, Mike, go ahead.
Okay, so my question is that the schedule that's attached, we're already off that schedule. And so if this is just an example, that's okay. But I think I'm concerned that I think the implication here is that you've said that if we can't get the grading done this fall, that we will do it next spring. But again, in terms of setting expectations, this schedule shows full completion by September 25th, but we're already 2 months late off of this schedule. So why is this schedule not up to date, or why are we not reflecting that in our project milestones?
The schedule is intended to show the overall project duration. Obviously, you know, we're just starting to advertise in March. This is a schedule that was put together by KPFF, the design consultant.
Okay.
The schedule that really has a practical implication is the schedule that the contractor will give us at the pre-con. And that's after advertising and awarding.
So when do we expect that to happen?
So we're opening bids on March 27th at 3 o'clock.
How long is that process?
The opening bids?
Is it?
We're advertising for 3 weeks, and then we do the bid opening. That exercise has there's a certain protocol that we follow, probably 20 minutes, depending on the number of bids that we receive.
So how soon after we make a selection are we anticipating the contractor will be on the streets?
Probably within weeks. It depends on what other projects they have going on.
So to translate that question, making the assumption they can start work fairly soon after we award the contract.
I assume that is that part of the RFP or RFQ or in terms of how they're scheduling and how soon they could start?
They are aware, because it's part of the bid documents, that we have windows that they have to operate within. So in order for them to be able to bid, they have to hit those windows, and they are aware that's all in the PS&E packet.
Do you have any because sometimes I see on projects, especially in Snohomish County, where they just let the people drag on and on and on. Well, geez, he had another job. You know, and people are inconvenienced in our area for months. So that's not going to happen to us.
And we've done everything we can
okay.
in the PSNE packet to guarantee that.
Well, is that something we can address through the contract, too, where there's... Or do we put penalties in there if it's not?
No, you will have a damage if they fail to meet timelines, like a penalty per day, provided it's not obviously beyond their control.
Understood.
Right. So there's liquidated damages. That's part of the WSHLET standard provisions.
But the point is that that will be an issue that we will be able to consider when you bring the contract to us with a recommendation of who we select. So
yeah, that's good. So we know that this is one of the largest projects we've done. This is a big deal. We've got money out there that I think potentially can expire if we don't get this done on time.
It's, so, it's for the 18 and 19 years, and we've already obligated the funds to be ready to go.
That's
and
good.
So that work is done, and we verify that it's through 19.
Okay, that's good. Concerned about, we always talk about the fish window. Are we restricted on this project in terms of fish window operation? I see a dewatering and fish something or other in here. It implies that we got to worry. So if we get too far off, so what's the scoop on that? Where does that fit in this schedule that's not accurate? Or not, shouldn't say not accurate, not, it's just a duration thing. Now you ship this over 2 months, do those things line up with a fish window?
So we should be okay as far as the fish window. That's the work that's done in the body of water.
Mm-hmm.
The only potential of an item that can slide is, again, that final lift, the overlay, the asphalt at the end. There's... temperature windows that typically you don't install HMA past October, but it's not necessarily based on the month, but more based on the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So the sliding of the schedule has that potential on the asphalt itself. Not
but the road
on the,
would
not
be open a, after material.
The road would be temporarily operational, yes.
That's not an issue.
No, I understand that. I didn't get the slowing down on the details, but this is a big deal. There's a fish window. Where does that, I'll ask the question a different way. Where does that fish window appear in this chart?
July, August, that's where it is.
And now we're in September, October?
Right.
On this chart, so is the fish window still open in September, October?
No.
So have we missed the fish window?
We have not. What happens is the whole construction phase shifts. And the potential is that the last items, which is that asphalt work, will not fit within what's on that schedule.
Maybe that's what needs to be explained, is what is the work that we're concerned about making sure is in that window? I think that's the question, because I think you're assuming that we're going to have to be down there digging those culverts, and we're going to have a narrow time to do that.
Whatever it is, I can't see it on here, but I'm concerned that that's 2 months later than
so what is the work that we're worried about getting in that? I mean, you mentioned the paving. Isn't there work with the culverts that is going to have to be
culverts,
done?
Culverts, the pile driving within the Penny Creek, the work that is done in the body of water. That's the work that needs to be done within that fish window.
So is that something that they can they, if we have constraints, are they able to adjust where they start
Absolutely.
With it? So they can start to do that work within the window if they have to drive the piles in that section of the road that would impact that, they can do that first and then move out to the areas that aren't constrained by the time window.
Correct. And so that's where the contractor, they, at the pre-con, after we open bids and identify the lowest responsible bidder, at that point, at the pre-con, the pre-construction meeting, they bring that schedule. And that's where they will show exactly what work they're proposing to do within that fish window.
So this won't be something that we will know when we sign the contract, but when we after we sign the contract, you'll have to sign off on the construction schedule that makes sure they're doing all the work inside that window.
Okay, and so all, what you're saying is not all the piles have to be driven.
Not all.
That right. Only some of this, some of the work is going to be done in the water. Okay. That's what I couldn't tell. That's what I was worried about. Because I'm looking at the 60 days of dry piles, which is contingent on test piles, contingent on procuring the piles. There's a lot of days in there.
And if something... And what you're really looking at too is your permit times, right? So we just want to make sure we're within those permit times.
Yeah, but the permit is in January and August. If we don't get it done by the end of August, they will close us down from working on the water.
The permit for Wild Fish and Wildlife is through November.
Well, am I...
November 6th.
Am I correct that going to these exhibits that really the area we're talking about is where the culverts are?
Yes.
I mean, that's the portion of the road where the culverts are is where we had the Army Corps issue. That's the area that we're concerned about. It's not doing the whole project within the fish window. It's doing the portions that were subject to the Corps' regulation, which is a pretty narrow area.
And they can be flexible with moving that.
And they can adjust their construction schedule, which staff will address when they do the pre-con to make sure they're doing all the work that needs to be done in that area within the window and that they can work around that.
Okay. Thanks.
Any further questions? Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Next up is the consent agenda, City Council meeting minutes of January 23rd, 2018, and City Council meeting minutes of February 6th, 2018. We have a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Reports? I don't have one. Mark?
None.
John? Vincent.
No report, Mayor.
No report.
I will be attending Snohomish County Cities next week. Other than that, no report.
Okay. Mike?
I'll defer my topic again to another week when we get more time.
Okay. Becca.
I would like to go over the quarterly financial report that is in your packet. I just wanted to say one of the things we've been talking about in past discussions of the financial reports is really just trying to do a deeper dive. We have a little bit of that in your packet today. Peggy's been working, you know, we've refocused her energies, moved some of her tasks to other departments so she can get into a lot of the processes. But I really want to call out, first of all, I want to thank her for the effort, because as I mentioned during the goal setting phase, we do not have the systems in place that extract this data automatically for us, but it is data that we need to manage by and to be able to do things like trends and analytics. And so a lot of this takes a lot of time because it's somewhat of a manual process using what little information can be automatically generated in order to kind of come up with some of these spreadsheets. So I just want to compliment her for the efforts and thank her for the efforts and ask her to just kind of provide an overview of the financial quarterly financial report. And this would be for the quarter ending December 31st. So it's actually not just a quarter report, but we were actually closing out the year, the 2017 year too.
Hey. All right. I will, I think in your packet I arranged it so that you guys could look through the graphs first. But for my number friends that are up there, I'd like to go back to the general fund report where we have the revenues. I think most of you have seen that. So this is for the general fund only, and as you will recall, back at the end of December, we did a budget amendment for about $400,000. That is now reflected in the total revenue budget of $25 million. We were at 24.6. We did the $407,000 budget amendment. You can see that the results from the revenue perspective are really strong. Property tax were about even. Sales tax has done stellar, and just to digress a little bit from the sales tax perspective, we've got a graph in here that shows what the pie chart looks like, and I know one of the questions that Councilmember Todd raised prior to this meeting tonight was, well, how much of that is the construction, and can we analyze that now so that when we look at the biennium budget going forward, we can take out those one-time revenues. So we do have the data to look at that, and it looks like we're at about $265,000 related to those one-time construction costs, which would be namely arena sports and the village vintage project. So we're at 265. We had budgeted to transfer 185 to CIP projects, which we did, I think, in the second quarter of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
We've done that. Now we've geared up. One of the budget amendments that we did was the $200,000 in the non-department to be able to transfer additional construction or CIP revenues at the time, which it seems prudent to do. So I just call that out for the sales tax. You know, the other standout is we've talked about, and I talk about in the report, is the passport revenue. We had a budget for the biennium of $450,000. We did that in the first year, which is unbelievable. So we've increased that budget $200,000. I straight-lined the budget. If you can look at that line item, you can see that I've got a $650,000 budget. The budget that we indicated through 12/31 is 3.25, even though we did the 450, because we just ran it through at a straight line, as opposed to trying to put it in the first 12 months. So revenue, if you look at the bottom line, total revenues are about $881,000 over what we projected, which includes the $400,000 of the budget amendment. We turn to the expenditures.
If I could just interject, sure. Just one thing. The 880, you know, I'm going to be coming back to you to discuss options for that 880. Part of that will be, one, does that continue to grow or does that fall off? Two, what impact does our CIP have? But I'm also thinking for the next biennium. You know, we've just renewed our fire contract. We renewed our guild contracts. And I want to look at how we slow our rate of increase in the budget to more closely match our revenue rate of increase. And so part of the way to do that is to set up operating reserves that you can be used to help slow future growth years. And so I want to kind of look at when we do have excess revenues over expenditures, how we can utilize those to help us in future operating years to slow the expenditure impact.
The general fund expenditures, you can see from a total perspective, we're about almost $120,000 under budget. We did do a budget amendment again to offset the revenue, so we increased the expenditure budget by $407,000, so we still have that balance within the general fund. $200,000, as I said, went to CIP, and the remainder of that went to various departments. We increased legislature. We increased city manager, the finance and administration, and then also the police department. You know, there's a couple of line items that are a bit over, but we would expect that as the budget rolls forward into 2018, we should be able to shore that up.
One of the things we have not adjusted yet is the salary account. So, for example, we had a position that may have been originally budgeted in permitting, for example. And after that position was vacant, we determined we didn't need to fill a permit position, and we reallocated it to finance to hire a position we needed. And so we have to go back now and reproject out those salaries and make internal adjustments by department. So that skews it a little bit when you see some of the salaries. We have an employee that started out in finance, but we moved to police. And so we just need to make some of those internal adjustments.
We need to extend the end. How much more time do you need?
I can do this in 5 minutes.
Okay.
So we have a motion to extend the meeting 10 minutes?
Up to 10 minutes.
Second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
All right. So our other revenue funds, those are our other special special revenue funds, as well as our enterprise funds. You can see that they're listed on the right-hand side. We have our city streets. We've collected almost 50% of what we had budgeted. We're a little bit higher on our expenditures. We had some front-loaded expenses for the first year in the biennium. The other one of note is the drug buy fund. We haven't really collected anything there, but we are expending revenues against the new canine that we've purchased. And then if you look at our CIP funds, we haven't really got into transferring the money for the projects as we wait for the development of the CIP project and look at that six-year focus along with, you know, 35th is obviously our most gating item. The next sheet is really just another way to look at the general fund. I'd like to pull out those transfers. This year has been kind of plain vanilla since we only transferred to the rec fund to support that because it doesn't support itself. Last year, what we'll do in subsequent presentations is we'll look at a comparative from last year to this year. Last year we had transferred the REIT money, so it's interesting to see how that pulls out and how the total operating expenditures line up with one another. The new report that I put in here was the expenditure by kind. When I go into a business, you know, I like to understand what the components are. And I thought it was interesting as we go through this if you look at salary and benefits overall, you know, 48% of the budget is associated with salary and benefits. If you look at just the general fund, it's 48% of what we bring in is salary and benefits. And then as you go down and you look at some of the other expenditures related to the general fund, we've got, let me get my little cheat sheet. Amounts related to professional services for the city. For the entire city, it was 5% of the entire revenue budget, which is, I think, about $40 million. If you look at just the general fund, we're looking at 3% or $336,000. Professional services legal has been a big expenditure for us this year as we contemplate some of the union negotiations, the Snowpack, Snowcom consolidation. The Rucker building was a big deal. Council elections and policy development. We've had some expenditures related to legal that aren't necessarily ongoing, reoccurring legal expenses. Services related to jail, prosecution, and defense and court costs, you know, that adds up. That's 4% of our general fund budget. And then the remainder, the 33%, goes to our fire, our dispatch services, and our SERS, our hardware, utilizes the dispatch. Then REIT this year, we had a bang up year for REIT. We've got almost $1.3 million that we've collected. I wish I could slice and dice that, but the first time I tried to get any information, the county wasn't able to get that for me. If I don't get it on the day that it happens, they lose track. At least that was the first story. I'll go back again so that we can understand it a little bit better and see where the transactions are taking place. And then CIP, like we've said, we've done a few things in the CIP, tape backup. We've done our website development, which will get the grant money in to offset those costs. We've spent very little in the Parks Department with Exploration Park at $81,000. We did a little bit in Mill Creek Sports Park for lighting. And then Road Improvement Fund, the big expense there was really the chip seal that we did with Wildflower and Mill Park Village. As I indicated earlier, the rec fund is 80% cost recovery ratio by itself. Without the general fund, we transferred about $110,000 to the rec fund this year. And then the last piece is our cash and investments. We've had bonds maturing. We have a ladder strategy. And as we get closer to the 35th and some of these other CIP projects, we've been reluctant to put money back in to have those bonds out in the future. The benefit that we've received this year is that the LGIP interest is up. It's up to, like, I think 1.48 now, where it was in the tank, you know, 0.4. I mean, just it was nominal. So at least we're earning some interest on the money that we're putting into the LGIP, so we can have a clearer picture going forward. And then the other comment that I like people to think about, since we're cash basis, we don't accrue for vacation. So if the city were to shut down today, all those people that are owed for their vacation or sick, that would be just south of $500,000 for the end of the year.
I just would like you to look at the expenditure in kind. This is what I use to determine, you know, what I look at when I'm focusing or determining what to focus on in terms of identifying efficiencies and project areas we want to look at. So, you know, salaries, right, was like kind of the first thing, and that's where we spent about 18 months really evaluating job functions, job descriptions, reorganizing. And then, of course, the fire contract. One, it was up, but we knew what a huge chunk of the budget it was, and so we spent on that. Now, 48%, I think we've dropped pretty significantly as a percent of budget. I'm trying to remember what it was when I got here, but it's a little misleading because a portion of that fire contract you have to think of as salaries because of the staffing of those 20 firefighters that you're paying for through that contract. So you look at both of those, but this helps me identify where we start needing to do cost-benefit analysis, aside from the obvious that we've already focused on.
Another way to look at salaries and benefits part of it, you talked about 48%. Well, it's really more like two-thirds of our budget of what you control. If you take the fire services out, because that's a contract, and yeah, it's got a lot of employees in it, but that's not within our control. If you take it out, then two-thirds of our business model is really people. So that's why you say it's so important to keep track of how we watch the benefit, costs and benefits.
Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing at opposite sides. But Councilmember Tao's right. If you take out the total budget by taking out the fire, which is really a salary thing, then that percentage goes up.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's another way to look at it.
Can I make a request?
Let's move.
Kind of noticing that a lot of us aren't really getting a chance to know exactly. Could you, next time you do this for us, could you put the slides
absolutely
up on the screen?
Sure. Yeah.
I think it would help us to follow along with you when you're providing a feedback on this.
Absolutely.
It would help ignorant me catch up.
And happy to sit down anytime you have questions, too, just to acclimate yourself.
Be careful. I'll buy coffee.
Peggy,
yes, I'm good.
Okay. Audience communication.
Once, twice.
Okay, with that, we. Sorry, what will?
I'm there.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.